Good afternoon, everyone. We'll call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is May 23rd, and we are going to have nearly a three-hour informational hearing on all things air quality. Well, I don't know if it's all things air quality, but it's a bunch of things air quality. So we're going to have an overview of air quality in Oregon, and an update on the Oregon, or the Cleaner Air Oregon Initiative. We're going to talk about the wood smoke work group. We're going to talk about diesel emissions and health risks, and then there are several pieces to each of those. So before we get it, have the first panel come up. I've invited Representative Taylor,
thank you. Help.
A long day.
To sit with us today. And I know she has a particular interest in the air quality issues in Portland, being from Portland. So I've invited her to join us. So with that, we are going to start. And if we could start out with David Collier, Sarah Armitage, and Palmer Mason will be our first panel to talk about air quality generally in Oregon.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. It's been a long day already, so thank you for having us, and thank you, Representative Taylor, for joining the committee. You've asked us to be here today to give you an overview of DEQ's air quality program, so we'll do that. I think it'll serve as a useful backdrop and foundation for the discussion that we'll be having later. It will not be focused exclusively on air toxics. We'll be addressing other issues as well and our monitoring for other types of pollutants. So with that, I'm just going to ask our staff, David Collier and Sarah Armitage, who are with our air quality planning program, to get started.
Great. Thanks, Palmer. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is David Collier, and I manage air quality planning for DEQ. And with me is Sarah Armitage, who leads our air toxics program. Thank you for the opportunity to kick off the panel and to provide you with an overview of DEQ's air program. Of course, we have a lot to cover today, and so our overview will be hitting some highlights, and our panelists will be providing more detail. For over 40 years, DEQ's air quality program has been reducing pollution and making Oregon safer. We've had great successes in doing that and in restoring Oregon's air to meet federal health standards. Over the years, in both rural and urban communities alike across the state, DEQ's air quality program has significantly reduced smog or ozone pollution, fine particulate, carbon monoxide, and other types of pollution to better protect public health. And that is a great success story for Oregon. And of course, we have much more to do. We have several big challenges in the air program these days, and the first are fine particulate and ozone, or smog. These are the two main areas where we see the greatest risk of violating federal air quality standards and triggering non-attainment in communities under the Clean Air Act. Oregon currently complies with the federal ozone standard, but in communities of Portland and Medford and Hermiston, we're seeing levels that are not too far below federal standards, and we need to watch that very closely going forward.
Could you Oregon explain, has really quickly, and I invite committee members to jump in whenever.
Sure.
Could you explain for those who don't know what non-attainment means.
Sure. Non-attainment is a designation under the Clean Air Act for communities that violate federal air quality standards. So if a community like in the past, Klamath Falls or Medford or Portland, violate federal standards at a point in that process, EPA will designate them non-attainment, which triggers a whole array of legal requirements for the community. It primarily means the air is unhealthy.
So, if you could expand a little bit on what the downstream effects of that are, what does that mean? So, in sure. terms of enforcement, in terms of regulatory authority, who's regulating that type of stuff?
Right. Sure. If a community goes non-attainment and is triggered under the Clean Air Act, there is a prescribed, legally binding timeline for which states need to develop an enforceable plan to bring the area back into compliance with standards. So our first move has always been to work with the communities to first understand what's going on, to what's driving the non-attainment problem. We do that through a lot of analysis. We work with community leaders, elected officials, to try to tailor a strategy that works for the community, reduce emissions. So there's legal consequences if you fail to meet that timeline. EPA can ultimately take over and create a federally enforceable plan for that community. It can tie up important transportation funds if you fail to solve that problem. Plus, the longer you go, the more the public is breathing unhealthy air. And also, I was going to hit this in my slide a bit, but just the stigma of being known as a non-attainment area can be a detriment to economic development and attracting business to a community. And often the plans that go with non-attainment can impose pretty strict requirements on existing industrial sources. So it's I've heard it described as a 30-year date with EPA if you go non-attainment.
Okay, so non-attainment doesn't become just like a 2-year thing.
No, you have to do a plan that typically takes several years to develop. You have to bring the air into attainment with standards, into compliance with standards. Then you have to do another 10-year plan to show that you're going to stay in compliance. And then quite often you have to do another 10-year plan after that. So once you trigger non-attainment, it's a long date with EPA, which is why a big part of our focus right now in communities that are at risk of non-attainment is to avoid going non-attainment, to take the measures we can now to not violate standards and avoid that whole non-attainment problem.
Follow-up for clarification, and the non-attainment is at the county level or it's at the metropolitan level or at Who is non-attainment?
Sure, thank you. Good question. It depends on the area being influenced by the air pollution. It can be as small as a town of several thousand people. It can be as large as the entire Tri-County area for the Portland metro area.
Senator Whitsitt, did you have a question?
Yes, I do. I don't think anybody is interested in breathing, poor quality air. But one of my problems, and I've talked to Palmer about this a number of times and others, is the lack of monitoring that you do in order to create these areas of non-attainment. I have three in my district, Prineville, Lakeview, and Klamath. Each of them has one monitoring station. The one in Lakeview is located between a house down by the railroad track, between a house that has a non-certified stove, wood stove, and on the other side of it is a shop that has been there for years and years. A guy heats it by burning used oil. And not that that would influence that particular monitor. The one in Klamath is the tree has grown up around it, the shrubs have grown up around it, and it has very little relationship to, is my understanding, into the measurements that are out at the air base. However, you only consider one. You don't do the two. The one in Prineville is almost as badly located. And then I was at a football game here a while back, and we happened to be sitting with the young guy who models for you. And I was asking him, how do you model? How do you make a model off of a single point? You can draw, last time I went to took a mathematics course, you can draw a line in any direction from a single point. So how do you do that? So, I mean, I think one of the things we should be looking at very closely is how we are establishing that these towns or areas are, have an air quality problem. Now, you know, in the exact opposite is this the using epiphytic moss to identify cadmium. I mean, so here we have a deal where they had 346 different locations around the city of Portland, and they measured it, and they actually showed that you know this is a problem. It is a dense problem. It is in relationship to a couple of emitters, and when they made that clear, the emitter stopped using cadmium and it went away. I mean, that's the kind of science we should be looking at. But you know, I just wanted to kind of set that tone, because if you look at the map here, do you understand how big Lake and Klamath and Cook counties are? And you got one station in each county.
So could you speak to that about the monitoring process and how you decide where to put monitors and things like that?
Sure. Senator Edwards. Senator Witz, great question. Thank you. It depends a little bit on which pollutant we're talking about. But, for example, fine particulate, when we're starting in the community, we will often do a survey. We will put many different samplers out around a community to try to get a sense of where the levels are high and whether the levels are low. That kind of information will guide us into putting what's called a federal reference monitor, which is and you're quite right, typically a single monitor representing the area of greatest concern in the community, where we will then gather the data. And that's where EPA has us site these monitors in order to characterize the areas where the public is at greatest risk and the area that's likely to either violate or not standards. So that where that location we pick is the bellwether for the community.
So if I may, Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, you're right. You and I have talked about this several times, and I think I agree with your premise that it would be more representative of the air that the community breathes if there were more reference monitors. But as David has said, and you and I have talked about before, the federal guidelines simply require that we place that one monitor, that one reference monitor, in the location deemed the worst in terms of public health in the air. So it's really a policy choice that we haven't made, that EPA has made, that's how the monitoring is to be done.
Can I follow up on that?
Yeah.
Palmer, I agree that that appears to be what the EPA requires. But as was stated a moment ago, in order to establish where you're going to put that monitor, you have done the work. How often do you do that work? Just once in 50 years?
Yeah. We'll typically do it when we're first establishing a presence in a community where we have our first indications that they might be having problems. So we'll do a study and locate our monitor. We can do it if we revisit their plan, say 10 years later, but typically the high high peaks of pollution in an area don't shift around that much. Mm-hmm. So once we have a good feel for where the high levels are, it's not going to really change that much over time.
Even when trees grow up and shrubbery grows up and people come move in to use different. I think that if we're going to, when you talked about the industrial. There's a reason why industries don't come in. If you have a non-attainment area, then the industries are not going to get a pollution permit, and so therefore they won't come. Right. So it's not a matter of they don't want to come. It's a matter that they can't come. And so my point is, and I beat it to death, and I'll stop. But the point is, once you have established that area, it doesn't mean it's going to stay that way forever. And I think you really owe it to the communities to, from time to time, reevaluate whether that's still a situation that is still in the proper situation, mm-hmm. proper location. I'll leave mm-hmm. it there.
I agree. All right. I'm going to move on somewhat quickly, but feel free to ask questions more. Of course, air toxics is a serious concern, and this is a very complicated field involving many different types of air pollutants and sources, and can involve health effects ranging from elevated cancer risk to possible neurological damage, so an extremely important part of the work that we do. Other priorities we have include climate change and helping protect visibility in Oregon's wilderness areas, and many of the pollutants that we deal with, like wood stoves and diesel engines and motor vehicles, contribute to several problems at once. And we'll talk more in a little bit about multi-pollutant strategies for our presentation. The AIR program, we manage both federal regulations under the Clean Air Act and our own state initiatives to fill gaps in the federal regulations and help meet Oregon's own clean air goals. So generally speaking, EPA sets national standards and goals, but DEQ also sets some standards and goals and makes regulations. We monitor and assess for pollution. We develop strategies to reduce that pollution and implement those through our permitting program and through regulatory and non-regulatory activities. And we help people with information and compliance, and we perform compliance and enforcement when we need to. This chart up here is just really a greatly simplified view of what all that looks like. And so I'm just going to quickly start on the left and go across. Under the Clean Air Act, EPA sets federal air quality health standards for criteria pollutants, which is ozone and fine particulate and carbon monoxide and sulfur and nitrogen dioxide and lead. And as I said, this is the area where Oregon deals with issues really of federal non-attainment. We implement federal and state permitting programs for large and small industrial sources through our Title V and our air contaminant discharge permit programs. And in those programs, that's where we establish operating conditions for facilities and manage emissions growth and implement requirements under the Federal Air Toxics Program for emission control technologies. Oregon also benefits from federal regulations for vehicles and fuels that result in cleaner cars and trucks and engines. For example, tighter federal emission standards for new diesel trucks or low sulfur fuels. Also under the Regional Haze Program, we work to improve visibility in our wilderness areas. And DEQ is responsible for air quality in all parts of the state except in Lane County, where the Lane Air Protection Agency has jurisdiction, and we provide oversight. Oops. We also have several state initiatives to fill gaps in the federal programs and help Oregon meet its own goals. Our state initiatives fall generally into three main focus areas: air toxics, motor vehicles, transportation, and climate change. And as I've said, air toxics is a very complex subject, and we've made good progress to date in the state, but we do have more to do. For example, there are no federal air quality standards for air toxics. And over the last few years, DEQ has worked through our expert science advisory panel to review the latest public health and medical research and update our clean air goals for 52 air toxics that are most relevant for Oregon. And these are known as our air toxics benchmarks. And they're meant to guide our actions to study and reduce these pollutants. And Oregon is one of the few states to really have ambient clean air goals for air toxics. And we're a leader nationally in this area. Our air toxics program includes elements for monitoring and health assessment, as well as community-wide and source-specific planning. We operate an initiative-based clean diesel program to reduce diesel emissions where we can. And diesel particulate is one of our most dangerous air toxics and also a source of fine particulate and greenhouse gases. And, of course, most recently, we've initiated development of health-based permitting regulations for industrial sources that will make our state-based approach to air toxics more complete. And you'll be hearing more about that in a few minutes. The motor vehicle and transportation sector is one of our biggest sources of air pollution, and Oregon has several state initiatives to address motor vehicles. We have our low-emission vehicle program that ensures Oregon sees the cleanest cars available, including electric vehicles, and our vehicle inspection and maintenance program, which helps ensure that cars, as they age, are maintained so they operate as cleanly as they're designed to operate. These programs reduce multiple types of air pollution at once, including particulate, ozone-forming pollution, greenhouse gases, and air toxics. And they're among a couple of great examples of just multi-pollutant strategies. In climate change, of course, we have several significant initiatives to address greenhouse gases, and those include the Clean Fuels Program, otherwise known as Low Carbon Fuels. That's designed to reduce the average carbon intensity of Oregon's transportation fuels by 10% over 10 years. So cleaner fuels together with cleaner vehicles makes a more complete strategy for reducing greenhouse gases from transportation. We had been working on the Clean Power Plan to reduce greenhouse gases from the electricity sector, but nationally, development of that plan is on pause, pending the outcome of some federal litigation. But I'm happy to say we've developed some really strong partnerships with our stakeholders and other agencies and other states around that program. So I think Oregon is very well respected in regard to that work.
What was it that you said is on pause?
The Clean Power Plan, the federal EPA's Clean Power Plan for electric generation. And the 2016 legislature tasked DEQ with conducting a study of how market-based greenhouse gas reduction programs such as cap and trade might work in Oregon, and we're working on that study right now. And finally, we have our greenhouse gas emissions reporting program so we can document the greenhouse gases occurring in Oregon. Monitoring is at the heart of the air quality assessment and science that we do. And this map, we show just our more permanent statewide monitoring network, which is primarily focused on criteria pollutants like ozone and fine particulate, but also shows some long-term general purpose air toxics trend sites. And our monitoring network is worked out with EPA. The blue dots show our annual sites where we have a long-term presence to monitor for things like fine particulate and ozone, where we have to show compliance and track trends. And the red triangles show more of our summertime sites where we monitor for fire. We have, in general, about 45 air monitoring sites across the state at any time, but that varies by our need and by our funding. We do several types of air monitoring assessment, including short-term studies, not shown on this map, where we investigate specific issues of concern. And Sarah's presentation will talk a little bit more about some of that short-term air toxics monitoring studies. And in addition to monitoring data, we gather and analyze emissions from all types of sources, and sometimes we use computer models to help analyze the impacts on communities. So that's broad brush on our monitoring. And one of our biggest challenges is also one of our biggest success stories, and that's helping Oregon communities deal with and avoid federal non-attainment and being designated non-attainment. We've talked a little bit about the consequences of non-attainment, unhealthy air, the stigma of non-attainment effects to on local economies and just lots of regulation. But this map shows an overview of where we've worked with the communities to be successful. The green stars show our success stories, and that's communities where we've worked with them over the years, and we've brought their air quality back into compliance with standards, and now we work there to maintain that compliance. The black triangles show where we have current non-attainment areas, that would be Oak Ridge and Golden Falls, and we're working to develop new attainment plans in partnership with those communities and EPA. The gray triangles show areas that have violated the particulate standard recently but have not yet been designated non-attainment, and that's where we're working very hard in these communities to reduce pollution and avoid non-attainment. And the white triangles show areas of concern for PM2.5 and for ozone. Specifically in Burns and in Hillsboro, we've had recent 2.5 levels over the standard but not violations yet. And then out in Hermiston, we've had some unexpectedly high levels of ozone. So we're working on plans with Burns in Washington County to reduce fine particulate, and we're also working in Washington with Washington State to get a better sense of what's happening in the Hermiston area. There might be a little interstate transport of pollution going on between Oregon and Washington. And it's important for us to work with all these communities where we can to avoid non-attainment. Its consequences are so significant.
What type of a timeline do you have or horizon do you have in front of you from the time that you have an area of concern or you're in violation but you're not yet designated non-attainment? Like, how much time do you have to kind of work out a cooperative community-based solution to get into compliance?
There's no fixed timeline, and that's why our partnership with EPA is really critical. We bring them in early to help us work with the community because everyone's interest really is in getting the air clean and avoiding non-attainment if we can. So once there's an official violation, once EPA takes action to designate an area non-attainment, then the clock starts. But if you're having problems in the community, there's a lot of if you're making a good faith effort, if you're really working hard to take the steps you need to take, the partnership with us and EPA and the community will allow quite a bit of time to solve the problem if people are really working in that direction. Now, just quickly in closing, of course, in all these communities, we work really closely with the local elected officials and community leaders. And every community is unique, but I can say pretty universally across Oregon that for PM 2.5, the fine particulate, excessive wood stove smoke is really the driver for non-attainment area risk. And that's why we spend so much time working in these communities on wood stoves and home heating issues. The communities really that we've worked with, Oak Ridge and Klamath Falls and all the others, have really taken the initiative to help join us and solve this problem, so that's fantastic. As you'll hear more about a little later on our panel, House Bill 3068 tasked DEQ to convene a work group on wood stoves and find new ways to help these communities have the ability and the resources they need to take on these risks of non-attainment. So that's just a quick overview of the AIR program in broad brush. And now I'll hand it over to Sarah to talk a little bit more about our AIR Toxics program.
Thanks, Stephen. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Armitage. I work in DEQ air quality planning. And as David said, I will give you a pretty brief overview of our AIR Toxics program. AIR toxics come from many sources, as David has mentioned, the majority of which also produces criteria pollutants, such as particulate or chemical precursors to ozone. Generally, people are exposed to the most risk from what we call area sources. So those are not the large industrial facilities, unless you live very close to them, but instead they're things like wood burning and cars and trucks, all sorts of engines burning. For those living close to industrial facilities, the emissions can also add an unwanted increase in health risk, and we've recently discovered that near the Art Glass facilities. Oops. So this chart drills down a little bit into DEQ's air toxics program. You saw a larger chart that David put up. This is just really the Oregon air toxics part of it. And it shows the elements of our program. In purple, we implement federal requirements for industry through permits. The green box shows our air toxics benchmarks to assess problems and provide solutions statewide and in impacted communities. And in blue, we have progressively cleaner engines as EPA sets standards for new gasoline and diesel-powered vehicles. So examples of our current actions to reduce air toxics are in the gray boxes that are below in this chart. We know that implementing federal regulations for industry has resulted in significant reductions of air toxics statewide for our largest facilities under Title V permits and a spectrum of medium and smaller facilities that operate under state permits. So some examples of facilities where federal regulations have required air toxics reductions are the larger wood products facilities and manufacturers, foundries that make metal, and vehicle painting businesses. In the past 5 years, EPA air toxics regulations have also applied to many medium and smaller facilities, requiring air toxics controls at dry cleaners, auto body shops, and metal plating facilities. DEQ partners with industry associations to provide technical assistance to hundreds of the smaller facilities each year. To supplement industrial and engine standards, DEQ uses a geographic approach to assess and solve problems in communities. And this is analogous to the approach that we use to solve problems for ozone and particulate, but we do it for air toxics as well. So we monitor for air toxics in communities statewide. And Portland Air Toxic Solutions, you may have heard of it, it's our first project that we had working with the Portland metro area to identify and make plans to reduce air toxics from sources causing the most risk. These include plans for wood burning, diesel engines, gasoline cars, and trucks and metals facilities. We also consider actions to reduce air toxics emissions from sources statewide. Examples of these actions are DEQ's Clean Diesel Program, which provides incentives for cleaner engines, Heat Smart, which requires change out of old dirty wood stoves upon home sale, and our gasoline fueling regulations, which capture benzene vapors upon refilling of the underground storage tanks. Under federal clean engine laws, both gasoline and diesel cars and trucks have gotten much cleaner over the years, resulting in less ozone, particulate, greenhouse gas, and toxic air pollution. And then Oregon, in turn, has accelerated this process by opting into California low-emission vehicle standards. So the current situation where we identified metals emissions at levels of concern from art glass facilities has highlighted what we and others have called a gap or a risk gap in our regulations for air toxics. This graphic roughly illustrates that gap. If you think about all the air toxics in Oregon in our air, they're contained in this whole circle, the outer circle. The ovals that are inside that show the levels of regulatory coverage. The inner oval shows the body of federal regulations for air toxics. These are technology-based controls that are expressed generally in terms emitted, in tons emitted per year, or in work practices that are required by the federal rules. And this is coupled with a federal review of how well requirements protect public health and potential updates to required controls. The federal air toxics regulations have been very effective at reducing emissions and risk nationally, but they do have limitations, and that is based on their generic nature. They're not tailored to each facility. They don't require site-specific risk assessment or risk reduction at each individual facility based on conditions right at that location. So in some cases, they may adequately control risk, and others they may not. The second oval, the green one, shows DEQ's geographically based air toxics program, so Portland Air Toxic Solutions and any other community that we may work with to assess and control air toxics. So this approach evaluates industrial emissions as part of the whole airshed. So it looks at them in together with emissions from engines and wood smoke and commercial activities. However, under this approach to date, we have not been exact enough to understand or control risk to people in neighborhoods close to industrial facilities. The geographic approach may be better suited to assessing and controlling emissions from area and mobile sources. So the outer oval here that's not filled in with the color represents industrial air toxics emissions that are not adequately addressed by either federal regulations or Oregon's current risk-based approach.
So before we move on, so if you had under the federal regulations a technology-based approach, you could theoretically have, you know, any given source is well within the limits, but then if you stack enough of those sources into one particular geography, then we're kind of out of bounds from a health-based perspective, or is that, did I miss?
Chair Edwards, yes, that that could happen. You could have multiple facilities within an airshed that are in compliance, and you could still be measuring levels of toxic air pollutant that are above an allowable risk level.
Plus non-point source. You know, just
that's correct.
General vehicle fleet and everything.
Yes, yes. Every airshed is composed of emissions from multiple sources.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Can I just follow up? Sure, thank you. Sarah, so why has this not been the methodology to date, would you say? I mean, what it seems so commonsensical, right, to look at the entire airshed. This is just kind of legacy from the way the Clean Air Act was first developed, or... I mean, I think that's a question a lot of people are asking. You know, why hasn't DEQ been looking at it this way for decades?
Well, Senator Denbrough, that's a great question. You know, I think the laws and the science of air toxics has really been evolving over the last 20 years, and there was a lot we didn't understand at the time the Clean Air Act was amended, and I think our knowledge and EPA's knowledge has really grown over the years. EPA did intend to take an airshed look at, in the urban air toxics program, but that part of their program really didn't get as far along as their technology-based controls, which were very important to do. As I understand it, Oregon is one of few states that really does look at airsheds in terms of toxics. It's a very complex approach to take. I know that there are a few locations in California where they have community initiatives where they're taking that same approach.
Mr. Brzozinski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've heard from people in the Lane County area concerned about maybe overreaching on the part of DEQ trying to address the issue in Portland regarding the glass. My understanding is that particular process that's used is a older process, heavier, deeper. I'm not sure exactly all the technical part, but some of the people I'm dealing with say that they get the glass after it's gone through certain processes. But they're concerned that the rules may be overreaching and putting them under a more stricter guide than necessary. Have you heard anything from glass makers or users of glass of that concern?
Senator Brzozinski, we did do a temporary regulation just to address glass facilities, and I know we're still working on that. It was intended to only control the facilities with the highest emissions that could be causing risk to public health. And others who are up after me may be able to address that question better than I can.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. So here is a map showing locations for our air toxics monitoring. The blue dots show our two long-term full monitors, meaning all of the air toxics that we measure. These are funded by EPA in Portland and in LaGrande. And Portland represents our, you know, biggest urban area. LaGrande is a smaller community in the rural area of the state. And EPA funds both of these to track trends. The orange dots show two full-year or longer monitors, and these are currently located in southeast Portland, and we also have one project that is soon to be commenced in Gresham, Oregon. The green dots show locations where we're conducting special studies. Right now, they're for metals in Portland and for naphthalene in the Dalles. The red and purple circles show locations where we... And in the case of Eugene, Lane Regional Air Protection Agency have conducted air toxics monitoring assessments in the past. The 2016 legislature gave DEQ additional resources for two full air toxics monitors, and these monitors will be in place by the end of 2016. And Brian Bowling, who follows, will discuss that in a lot more detail. So these charts show air toxics trends for five key pollutants that are longer-term monitors in Portland and LaGrande. And they show generally good news that on a larger scale, emissions of air toxics are decreasing over time. Even though we see downward trends for these pollutants, levels can be still unacceptably high near emission sources such as industrial facilities or busy roadways. And also, there are many more air toxics of concern not shown on these charts. The vertical axis on this chart is times above our air toxics benchmarks, or our clean air goals, which are very protective. The five pollutants here are stacked in bars for each year to show air toxics trends. And the orange line and dots show our targets for air toxics reduction. You can see that the levels of these five pollutants are generally about twice as high in Portland as in La Grande. And this is because higher levels of air toxics come with density in development. This is a pattern we see in communities statewide. The resurgence of the economy and more vehicle and truck traffic likely shows the increased levels in 2012 and 2013. And also we know that meteorology has a large influence on pollutant concentrations. So that means stagnant air patterns versus unsettled windy weather. And this may explain the drop in pollutant concentrations in 2014 in Portland. We know that was a year with good ventilation and very few periods of air stagnation. So before we move to the next panel, I'd like to emphasize that further good news, that much of our work has benefits for multiple pollutants, as David mentioned earlier. So traditionally, we addressed one pollutant at a time, but now we think more in terms of multi-pollutant benefits. On the left side of this chart are some of our key source control efforts, and across the top are the key pollutants that we need to reduce. Because sources of air pollution emit multiple pollutants, our source control efforts are effective for multiple pollutants. For example, cleaner engines and cleaner fuels reduce particulate, air toxics, ozone, greenhouse gases, and pollutants affecting visibility. Wood smoke reduction efforts control particulates, air toxics, and pollutants affecting visibility as well. And then industrial controls in place statewide have benefits for all categories of pollutants. So that's all I have. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
On the toxic slide, back. So those six, or no, those five. Why those five? Which ones aren't included that should be included? Is that a good? If you're monitoring those, are you probably catching other co-pollutants as well? As long as you're managing for those, or I mean, like, why those five?
Yeah. Well, Senator Edwards, that's a great question and a very complex area. I know that we set these up as part of our key performance measures because we thought they were representative of certain types of pollutants and activities that come from key activities. So we wanted to make sure to capture some metals. We have arsenic and benzene on here. Arsenic comes from multiple sources. I'm sorry, arsenic and cadmium. Arsenic comes from multiple sources. Cadmium comes from just a few, and you can see it's really not present in La Grande. We chose benzene and acetaldehyde because they're products of combustion, of fossil fuels, and also of wood, which is burned in a lot of communities causing toxics. And formaldehyde comes along with almost burning anything, and it also forms in the air from precursors on its own. So we really just felt like those were good representatives if we wanted to look at some trends. Benzene in particular, we see downward trends because of the great advances that have occurred with engines, with car engines, gasoline engines, and also the reduction of benzene content in gasoline. It's pretty much been cut in half since 2012. So that's a trend we can witness by stacking these up and looking at them together. But there are many other pollutants that we could look at, and it might be a slightly different picture for the community depending on which pollutants we looked at.
Okay. Any other questions for this panel?
No.
Okay. Thank you each.
Thank you.
Next up, Joe Niehaus, Max. I'm not sure how to say your last name, Max. So, Max, you know who you are. And then Maureen McGee. Actually, Maureen, why don't you come up at the same time?
Oh, so come up now?
Yeah.
Good afternoon. My name is...
And really quickly before you start, the next panel up after this is going to be an update on the Cleaner Air Oregon Initiative. We'll hear from DEQ and OHA folks, everybody that's on the agenda to present on that. And then diesel emissions, that panel is going to go next. So the diesel emissions is going to go before the wood smoke panel. So if you're those people... take note. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Joni House. I'm the Public Affairs Manager at Lane Regional Air Protection Agency. I'm here today with my colleague, Max Huffley, who is our Permit Section Manager. And we're here to talk to you about the only regional air authority in the state of Oregon. So our vision and mission are stated here. It's very similar to DEQ's air quality program. We were created about almost 50 years ago under ORS 468A 100 through 180. And we'll get into that a little bit more later. But when authorized to do so by the EQC, the regional authorities are empowered to do so essentially the same air quality functions as DEQ. So we operate very similarly to DEQ's air quality division. This is a little map of Lane County. Our geographic size is similar to the state of Connecticut, so we cover about 5,000 square miles or so. And in it, we have a lot of different airsheds within our community. We've got the coastal ranges, we've got the valley, as well as very mountainous regions to the east. And we have 7 air quality monitoring stations currently throughout the county. This particular map doesn't exactly state where the monitoring stations are, but we have 3 in the city of Eugene, 1 in the city of Springfield, 1 in the city of Cottage Grove, 1 in Saginaw, which is on the I-5 corridor between Cottage Grove and Eugene, and 1 in the city of Oak Ridge, which is currently our single non-attainment area for particulate matter. A little brief history about air quality management in the state of Oregon. So in the 50s, the Oregon Legislative Assembly established the first air quality pollution controls. And later on in the 50s, the Air Pollution and Water Pollution Prevention Programs combined to create the Oregon State Sanitary Authority. And with the Sanitary Authority, there were some measures to follow the rules that would eventually be under the Clean Air Act. In 1955, the Air Pollution Control Act was adopted, which predates the original EPA's Clean Air Act. So the Clean Air Act was first implemented in 1963 and amended and adopted in 1977 and 1990. And in between those times, in the late 60s, Lane Regional Air Protection Agency, along with 2 other regional air authorities, were formed. And then later in 1969, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality was formed, and eventually the other 2 regional air authorities were combined into DEQ's air quality program. So the previous other local air agencies were the Columbia Willamette Air Pollution Authority in the Portland metro area and the Mid Willamette Air Pollution Authority in the Salem Corvallis Albany area. Both of these local agencies were multi-county, and it did create some complex funding structures and eventually were combined with the ODEQ air quality program because of these issues. Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority, we changed our name several years ago to the Air Protection Agency, been able to stick around. We have a single county to manage, and our structure is pretty straightforward, and we've gotten lots of support from DEQ and the EPA. These are our 4 goals. 1 is air quality, to ensure healthful air quality for all Lane County citizens. 2 is involvement, inform and involve citizens and businesses in improving air quality. 3 is service, serve citizens and other stakeholders fairly, courteously, and in a timely manner. And 4, partnerships, work with other partners to leverage resources to make a difference in local air quality. And being a local agency, we value having local control. Like I mentioned earlier, Lane County has several different airsheds. We have similar problems in our airsheds with the rest of the state, but we also have very specific issues just to our county. Our board of directors and advisory committee is comprised of local citizens and officials and citizen appointees. And we also are able to target our specific problem areas, such as the city of Oak Ridge, who's been struggling with being in non-attainment for particulate matter for the last 12 years. And the decisions for our agency are made locally, not in Salem or Portland. And our rules, though, they must be as stringent as the state and federal requirements. So this is the current makeup of our board. We have local city councilors as well as Layton County commissioners. We've recently added a seat to our board to make room for both Cottage Grove and Oak Ridge. That used to be a rotating seat, and have the Oak Ridge mayor sitting on our board. As you can tell, there have been people that have been rotating on and off of here for several years. Okay, Max.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and committee members. My name is Max Heffley. As has been mentioned, our air quality functions are similar to those at DEQ. DEQ will often lead in the more regional-based program developments like the Clean Power Plan and Clean Fuels Program. LRAPA will get involved when those pending rules may affect our sources in Lane County, like, for example, the Greenhouse Gas Reporting Program and air toxics developments. We've been involved with those. Our civil penalty matrices are required by state statutes to be congruent with DEQs, and our stationary source permitting rules are required to be reviewed, if not approved, by the Environmental Quality Commission under state statute. So our programs have remained pretty similar over the years. One difference is that we've either retained or expanded our ability to regulate smaller sources like coffee roasters and surface coating operations. Here's a graph of our core operating budget. As is probably typical with a lot of air quality agencies across the country, there's been an increasing degree of reliance on permitting fees to fund our program. For example, we get about 39% from air contaminant discharge permit or ACDP fees and 28% from the Title V permitting program, as you may know, is the portion of the Clean Air Act carved out for so-called major sources. And then, of course, local, state, and federal funding are an important source of our overall budget. As David and others have mentioned, Lane County currently meets most federal air quality standards in most of the areas, but we do have the non-attainment area in Oak Ridge that's currently violating the PM 2.5 standard, which is a kind of a worst winter day 24-hour standard. Although the wood smoke emissions that have been monitored up there are the lowest we've ever recorded in the history of monitoring there, and so we're confident that by the end of 2016 that area will attain attainment with that standard. And then the former problems from the 1980s with PM10 and carbon monoxide are largely under control due to more efficient combustion.
In Oak Ridge, is that due to people slowly but surely changing out wood stoves, or
what? Yeah, it's a multifaceted strategy. Wood stoves change outs is probably been the most significant aspect of that. There's been some other ancillary strategies like having a program to provide more dry firewood so that the wood is properly seasoned prior to combustion. And a lot of public awareness, public outreach. At LRAPA, we receive and respond to hundreds of complaints each year. Most categories are steady or decreasing, with the exception of homewood heating and open burning, which either remain relatively constant or are increasing as we focus more on those categories.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I have a couple questions about that table. I noticed that the complaints of industry over the last 10 years, complaints regarding industry, have dropped 94%. I wonder if you could comment on that. And also on the open burning, there was a huge increase between 2006 and 2007. Was there some type of a local law passed regarding that about that time?
For open burning, you say?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Yes, Senator Whitsitt. The industrial complaint levels were quite high in the mid-2000s. That was largely driven by a situation surrounding a wood treatment facility called J.H. Baxter that I'm not sure of the breakdown on those, but it could be that those were, up to 80% from that one source. It was quite an odorous facility, and we entered into what's called a best work practice agreement under our nuisance control strategy rules to put on some engineering controls and changes in their work practices to eliminate or reduce those odors. We still continue to get odors in that area, but they've certainly been reduced. I think, if we had more room to go back several more years, it might, show a better or more complete picture. As far as open burning, I'm not really sure what that one-year increase from 2006 to 2007 was. We could certainly look into that and get back to you.
Thank you.
And then just lastly, this is a picture of one of our ambient monitoring stations, and it's an example of a partnerships that we have with the EPA and DEQ. We often partner together with them to do air monitoring and emission inventory to report and record air quality information. And so that's all we have.
Any questions?
Yeah, I do.
Sir Deborah.
Mr. Chair. Max, going back to the funding, to the budget, so most of the budget, as you said, is coming from fees. So does an industrial site pay the entirety of their fees to the local agency, or does some go to DEQ, some to the local agency? How does that work?
For the most part, almost, as on a basis of 100%, that is true. There are certain cases where LRAPA and DEQ establish a reciprocity agreement for certain portable sources like asphalt plants that could move in and out of the county. There's an arrangement where we have an agency that initially issues that permit will get that initial application fee, but those annual fees could be paid for each agency depending on how long that or if that portable equipment is operated in the county. But yeah, for the most part, almost 99% of those fees goes directly to each agency.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just wondering if I could follow up. I mean, I think one of the concerns, discussion is happening about a local air authority for the Portland metro area. And if all the fees in that area went to that authority, that wouldn't leave that much to go to DEQ, right? If Lane and the Portland Metro were in another system, so I mean, how would that work from your perspective?
Yeah, that is definitely something to consider significantly, Senator Dembro. And it has a rippling effect. A lot of the times our funding that we get is tied to matching, so that a $1 reduction in one area could lead to even 2 to 4 times a reduction in elsewhere due to the matching requirements that EPA and the state have.
Yeah. Sir,
thank you. Going back to a previous slide, local agency equal local control, it says also one of the bullet points, local rules must be at least as stringent as state and federal requirements. So are you saying that it's local control only to the standpoint of where your rules are more stringent than state and federal rules, or do you actually enforce the state and federal rules also, and is there an advantage to that doing that locally?
Yeah, we do implement certain programs that DEQ has implemented, either through necessity or convenience, that might be the case. For example, the Title V air permitting program, it's mostly stipulated and clarified in the Clean Air Act, so there's not a whole lot of leeway to do our own program there. So it just makes sense to not replicate the wheel, so to speak. In that regard, but we have the ability to go beyond the stringency. Through state statute, we can establish rules that are more stringent. For example, we could create tighter particulate limits on wood burning devices, industrial stacks. But for the most part, it just makes sense for us to partner with DEQ and maintain the degree of consistency so that businesses that are locating throughout the state can have a certain sense of consistency with regard to our rules.
So are you monitoring for things that, are you monitoring for any pollutants or toxics that DEQ does not monitor for?
You know, I don't believe so.
That list of five, you're monitoring for all those same five toxics?
We have done some metals monitoring. Those, you know, arsenic and cadmium are heavy metals. We've gone away from that because the monitoring levels that we've received were almost on the non-detect or, you know, almost undetectable. So we hadn't discovered or noticed any problems with metals. So we've been able to, in the last calendar year, we've saved some toxics monitoring money by not having to analyze for those metals. But we do all the others, the volatiles, the semi-volatiles, and particulates, those kind of things.
Yep, Senator Edwards, so all of our stationary monitors do the same as the DEQ monitors, where they're looking at either particulate matter or for ozone during the summer months. And then, like Max said, when we have the money, we also do air toxics monitoring year-round. But that's not an annual thing that we can do. It's just sort of consistent based on our available funding.
So if a special concern arose around a certain, say, toxic that was not being monitored, the local board could decide if it wanted to and could come up with the funding and, you know, make the budgetary decisions to do that. The local board could decide to do that monitoring without permission, per se, from the DEQ or something like that.
Right, yeah, and that's the case with the air toxics monitoring that we've been doing the last calendar year. That was something that came out of a directive from our board that they wanted that to be done, so they appropriated funds for that.
And on the other hand, during the Ways and Means budget process, LRAP is then also coming and asking for certain allocations, and legislators are looking at Floyd and I going, why does LRAP need, you know, I mean, there's pros and cons both ways. So, yeah. So what's it?
Looking at the slide here on your fees and your source of revenue, 67% comes from fees, 17% comes from federal grants, EPA. But I don't see any income from the Department of Environmental Quality. So are you doing the DEQ's work without being paid for it?
Well, I think the 8% through the state general fund contribution is where we get some of that. It's passed through, essentially, from the state. So that would be where the funding we get from the Department of Environmental Quality shows up on that graph.
Thank you.
Maureen, you want to tell us a little bit about the legal framework? Sure. I think we're getting the gist of it, but we may have a few questions about if a local jurisdiction were to want to go back to a more regional type approach.
Right.
What would have to happen?
Well, there's a few things that would have to happen. First of all, my name is Maureen McGee. I'm a deputy in the Office of Legislative Counsel. Thank you very much, Senator Edwards, for asking me to come speak today. I prepared a fairly detailed summary of what would have to happen and the summary of all the statutes in place. So if it works for the committee, I'll just move through that. The statutes that govern regional air quality control authorities, as Joe mentioned, are ORS 468A-100 through 468A-180. They set forth a process for forming a regional air quality control authority, the government governance requirements, the scope of the duties, the process for expansion or dissolution, and funding considerations. I'd prepared to talk a little bit about a history of those statutes, and I will, although Joe covered some of it, and I won't repeat what she said. These statutes were adopted in 1967. At that time, that was before we had a Department of Environmental Quality, and it was before the Clean Air Act, and the regional approach to air quality control that we see in these statutes is reflective of the approach that was taken by the federal government at that time, which was to send it to the states to come up with regional models for air quality control. And the statutes have been updated, or they were cleaned up a little bit in the early 1970s, but since then they haven't actually been updated. So the basic framework that we have for these is coming from the 1970s. I just put that in place to give you some context for thinking about establishing a new regional air quality authority or any potential discussions that there might be about cleaning up the statutes in anticipation of creating a new regional authority.
So when there were three regional authorities, and then the rest of the state wasn't covered because we didn't have a Clean Air Act yet.
Essentially. The other two authorities were the Mid-Willamette Valley Air Pollution Authority and the Columbia-Willamette Air Pollution Authority. The Columbia-Willamette consisted of the City of Portland, Clackamas County, Columbia County, Multnomah County, and Washington County. And that was assumed by the DEQ in 1973. The Salem area one was assumed by the DEQ a few years later. So under current law, a regional authority can be formed by any combination of two or more counties or cities with jurisdiction over a contiguous territory. In order to form the authority, the cities and counties proposing to do so have to adopt ordinances or resolutions that specify the name of the authority, the participating cities and counties, principal place of business of the authority, and the boundaries of the regional authority. That's kind of it. They submit certified copies of those ordinances and resolutions to the Secretary of State and the Director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and then they are reviewed by the Environmental Quality Commission, and the Environmental Quality Commission is required to approve formation of the authority if they can make two findings. The first finding is that the participating governments plan adequate financing for the authority. And the second finding is that the proposed region encompasses a territory that could that should reasonably be included within a regional authority for purposes of air quality control. There's also a general statutory requirement that the regional authority has a minimum population, but that requirement can be waived by the commission if the commission's able to make those other two findings. And one thing to note here is that these statutes do not contemplate a metropolitan service district as an entity capable of forming a regional authority. So, for example, if all or a part of the participating cities and counties in Metro wanted to form a regional air quality control authority, it would have to be formed by those cities and counties through the process that I just discussed, but as a separate entity from Metro under current law. Once formed, the regional authority becomes its own corporate body. It's required to have a board of directors of between 5 and 9 members that represent the governing bodies of the participating cities and counties. And the statutes lay out very specific requirements for representation on that board based on population. In fact, as Joe mentioned, El Rapa added a new member to the board recently, and they required statutory authorization to do that. They needed a small change to that board of directors statute in order to open it up enough that they could add that extra body. And I mentioned that recent change to flag that depending on how a new regional authority was envisioned to be adopted, this very specific board representation that's required by statute might again raise issues about equitable representation on the board. Like there may have been a concern with El Rapa recently. The statutes also require the regional authority to appoint an advisory committee to advise the board, particularly on protection of public health and property from the effects of air pollution. That committee is required to consist of at least 7 members, and it has to be people that represent certain enumerated interests within the region. Once the authority is formed, it is authorized to exercise all of the functions that DEQ exercises regarding air quality within the region, including establishing air purity standards, issuing permits, and monitoring all of that in the same manner that DEQ and EQC are authorized to do so. As you heard from El Rapa, the authority's jurisdiction is exclusive, except that the commission and fire permit agencies always retain regulatory authority over field and forest land burning, and an authority can contract with DEQ to have the department retain some of its duties that otherwise would have been delegated to the authority. It can adopt its own rules and air quality programs as long as they are at least as strict as any rule or standard adopted by the commission. And it must have its rules and standards approved by the commission before it can enforce them. It can expand its territory in the manner provided for forming a region, and it can be dissolved by written consent of the governing bodies of all of the participating counties. And then under that statutory dissolution process, all of the assets would be proportionately divided among the counties or cities. The Environmental Quality Commission can also take over the duties of a regional authority. The statutes say that if the commission determines upon hearing that the regional authority has failed to establish an adequate air quality program or is administering that program in a manner that is inconsistent with the state air quality laws, it can order the authority to take corrective action within a, quote, reasonable amount of time. If the regional authority fails to take that corrective action, the commission is directed to undertake a program of administration and enforcement of an air quality program in that territory, and that is what happened with the Columbia Willamette organization in the 70s. The authority can have its function restored if the commission determines it's capable of exercising those functions. Some important things to note here is that the statutes don't say what will be done with an authority's assets if the commission forcefully takes over the functions of the authority. And while the statutes talk about how a single county or city can join a larger functioning authority, there is no process stated in statute for a single participating county or city to withdraw from the authority. And those are both issues that came up in litigation when the Columbia Willamette Authority was dissolved in the early 70s. The final issue that the statutes address is funding, state funding. There's a reimbursement provision for consultation by state agencies provided to the authority. I believe that that was discussed in ORAPA's presentation. And there's a provision for state financial aid to the authority. That provision requires the regional authorities to apply to the Environmental Quality Commission for their state funding support. And it allows the commission to make funding determinations based on factors enumerated in statute. The statute requires the regional authorities to submit their applications for federal funding to the commission before they forward it on to the feds. Regarding how much state funding the authorities are eligible to receive, this statute says that it's based on a percentage of locally funded annual operating cost, which will max out at either 30% of local funding or 50%, and that doesn't include federal dollars, depending on the size of the agency. But there are potential ambiguities in this statute to be aware of. One is, earlier I discussed the statute governing formation, and that statute requires a regional authority to consist of any combination of two or more contiguous cities or counties. The state funding provision contemplates an authority that's operated by not more than one unit of local government, and that term unit of local government isn't defined anywhere in the statutes, and so it could possibly raise the question of whether the statutes would allow for a single unit of local government like the city of Portland to create a regional authority all on their own. I don't know how far that question would go, but the ambiguity could be there, so I felt compelled to point it out. And it also highlights the issue that there are a number of undefined and inconsistently used terms in these statutes. That's not unfamiliar for statutes that haven't been updated in a long time. It's something that could be clarified if it was revised to conform with modern legislative form and style, which also matches the form of statutory interpretation that's used by the Oregon courts. And I say that, but I also want to note that how important it is to fix these kind of inconsistencies really depends a lot on the kind of process that local governments would want to go through and the way that they would want to structure their own regional air quality control authority. I guess as just some final notes, I looked at DEQ's rules. They don't have rules specifically about the establishment or approval of regional air quality control authorities, but it would be within their jurisdiction to adopt those kind of rules if it was necessary to do so. If there was a new regional air quality control authority created, it probably would require rulemaking by DEQ in some form, not necessarily related to approving the establishment of the authority, but it would be a new delegation of authority by the DEQ to a local agency, and that would have to be reflected in the rules, similar to how their current delegation to LRAPA is reflected. And there may be other rulemaking required to make sure that, you know, the work of that new authority was properly reflected in documents required by the federal government under the Clean Air Act.
So if so two or more local governments, counties or cities?
Yeah. Any combination of counties or cities.
So it could be a city nested within a county.
All the statute says is two or more cities or counties, so conceivably, yes.
So Tigard and Washington County could?
Perhaps. The statutes say any two or more cities or counties that make contiguous territory. So since Tigard and the county are contiguous territories, it sounds like it would fit within the language of the statute, just thinking off the top of my head.
Okay. And then if we were thinking more, let's say we're talking adjacent counties,
mm-hmm.
then it would require a Board of Commissioner approval for each?
Yes, Chair Edwards. It would require the Board of County Commissioners for both counties to adopt ordinances and resolutions about the formation of the Air Quality Control Authority. And then those ordinances or resolutions would need to be submitted together to the Environmental Quality Commission for approval.
And then, based upon your reading of the statute, if Portland and Multnomah County wanted to form a regional air authority,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can they compel other people within the boundary of Multnomah County to be included?
So I didn't bring this.
Sorry, I didn't give you any of these questions. No, I mean, I'm thinking of them as we're talking here.
I didn't bring the statute book with me, but I believe in the language for formation. Or perhaps it's in the language of about the duties. If the county creates the regional air authority, then they're going to have jurisdiction over the county. They're going to have jurisdiction over over the air quality for all of the cities that are within that county. So, in the example that you gave, I believe the answer would be yes, but I would need to confirm that.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, I mean, is that essentially what happened with the Lane County Authority? Was it created by Lane County, and then all these cities were included?
Senator Denbrough, I don't know the exact history of Lane County's formation. I know that it went through, and perhaps the folks from LRAPA maybe be able to answer that question. I know that it went through, I believe that it went through a few different formulations, that it may have started just with Lane County even before these statutes were adopted. I believe that there were movements in Lane County to have an air quality authority. And I believe that other areas have joined in.
Senator Denbrough, it's to my knowledge that it started with the Eugene metro area, so it was the city of Eugene and the city of Springfield, and then the county joined later.
And so presumably, just follow up, there was never a question of it only applying to the unincorporated part of the county.
That I do not know, because it started with the two defined municipal areas.
Okay, so there's a process, and it doesn't necessarily require any statutory authority, although it sounds somewhat complicated, and it might streamline it if people wanted to go in that direction. I know, and I'm not advocating that it should happen or that it shouldn't happen. I just know there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not that is a direction that constituencies want to move. So,
yeah.
Representative, you've been quiet down there.
No, I'm just listening.
It's a Senate committee, but you're welcome to chime in and ask questions.
I've spoken with Maureen before, so yes, she's answered a lot of my questions before, but thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for the panel? Okay. Thank you each. Very helpful.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, we've got, we're running a few minutes behind, but we're not too far behind. So we've got the Cleaner Air Oregon Initiative. So Pete Shepard, Lynn Saxton, Leah Felden, and Brian Bowling.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I'm the interim director of the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm not going to be a candidate for the final for the permanent director selection, which is in progress as we speak. But I think my mission, as I view my mission, it is to help help my successor, whoever he or she may be prepared for decades more of success and improvement in the performance of the agency, as well as to help my current colleagues prepare to work with my successor. And certainly the question of addressing toxins and trying to fill that regulatory gap that was described to you earlier is a big part of what I think I can contribute, even though that process will not yield its final conclusion until long after my approximately 6 months of work have come to an end. Nevertheless, we're here with a very good panel for you, and I hope we can, at least I can make my contribution to getting you back on schedule by being very brief and leaving it to the real experts to talk about the process. So I'm joined by Lynn Saxton, the director of the Oregon Health Authority, whom you will hear a key part of this process is a new partnership with that agency. To my right is Leah Felden, special advisor for Cleaner Air Oregon, who I've appointed to be kind of the air traffic control, so to speak, for this project, make sure all the pieces are connected. And on my far left is Brian Bowling, who is the long-suffering and very hardworking head of our lab, where a lot of my dedicated colleagues have been burning the night oil to meet all the demands for analysis that we're confronting in many different communities. There are three features of the process that I'm going to describe a little bit to you that are I think crucial and different than things we've done before, and then some kinds of collaborative, some kinds of processes that I've been familiar with over the 23 years or so of my public experience before taking on this responsibility. The first is the extent of the public engagement. Leah Felden is going to describe this to you, but even though Cleaner Air Oregon, the project that Governor Brown launched to fill the gap that you heard described earlier, is at its root legal level simply a rulemaking or a regulatory reform process, the design of the project goes far beyond the minimum requirements of rulemaking, and Lee is going to describe in detail the very deep public engagement, which is going to include field hearings in communities all around the state. The second distinctive feature is the one I've already alluded to, which is a new, in this area of our operation anyway, full-on partnership with Director Saxton's work at the Oregon Health Authority. In the water quality area of our work, we're very accustomed to having OHA be a full-on partner with helping set standards for regulation of water quality. But in the air quality area, the Oregon Health Authority has been primarily an advisory function. Now we're full-on partners, and that's very important to us because of the third distinctive feature of the program, and that is that this program, Cleaner Air Oregon, is designed to yield science-based answers to how we might, for the first time, explicitly connect the regulation of emissions from permitted facilities to the potential risk to human health from those emissions. And that is not a feature of our current program, and it's not a feature that we can develop alone with the expertise of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. It has at its core consideration of the best principles of public health, and that's the area where Director Saxton and her colleagues are going to bring expertise to bear. So I think I've kind of described briefly. I think I would just say one other thing before I move to the next slide, and that is that this is not simply a Portland metropolitan area issue, because the sources, the potential sources of emissions that have potential public health consequences are not limited to Portland. We permit facilities all over the state, and some of those, at least, have the potential to fall into the gap that's been described to you previously. And so Cleaner Air Oregon is not merely a question of setting special standards for one area of the state. It is instead a question of setting standards that help create a healthy economy and a healthy environment for all Oregonians, including every place in the state. I mentioned briefly the new approach to...
Just a second, Senator.
I have several questions that hopefully you will address as you go along regarding the last slide. So who determines what is potentially toxic? Who determines what is a risk to human health? Is this going to be public perception, or is this going to be a science-based thing with a level of statistical confidence? And when we get to the Rules Advisory Committee, the way I read that paper, the Rules Advisory Committee will not have a vote. The Rules Advisory Committee, there will be no requirement for consensus. They'll just be interviewing individual members of the Rules Advisory Committee for input, which seems like a complete separation from the current Rules Advisory Committee process. So I wonder, you know, as you go along, if you would address some of those things and make me a lot more comfortable.
Sure. Senator Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, good to see you again. And let me answer first the question of the science-based rulemaking. And I think that your question goes to the heart of why I think this ought to be this effort ought to enjoy consensus support among Oregonians of all views about how to reform our regulations to better address the question of human health in air toxins. Because your point is exactly correct. These cannot be regulations simply based on perception. This process must yield a very well-informed scientific basis for understanding in a science-based way the connections between the formulation of our regulations and the net public health benefit for Oregonians. Now, Director Saxton is going to talk to you a little bit about the various parameters of that net public health benefit. But I think the key in answering your question is that I welcome the challenge to have this issue be framed around best principles of science, because there we can have a principled discussion about setting the right level of risk in relation to the consequences of picking different levels of risk in our regulatory scheme. And if that discussion is based on an attempt to evaluate the best principles of public health and science underlying that determination, then that's a principled debate, and policymakers can calibrate the risk at a sensible level. If that rulemaking is based on some other non-measurable, non-objective standard, then I think we end up with a regulatory scheme that, as a regulator, I would find it very difficult not only to explain but also to enforce in a principled way. So I'm with you on the question of basing this on science, and I think that route is the reason that I think this ought to be a consensus effort among all Oregonians.
Follow up. I agree with you, what you're saying, except that the term science and consensus are antithetical to one another.
Senator Edwards and Senator Whitsitt, I think that goes to the question that you raised about the process, and let me address that directly. We actually have three. We're going beyond the mere minimum of the Administrative Procedures Act rulemaking process. We actually have three advisory groups. We have a technical advisory group, and these are people with extraordinary credentials in the science. And I take your point that not all scientists agree, but at least there's a principled way for discussing the differences among scientists. You can talk about whether the data is valid. You can talk about whether the conclusions are valid. That's a principled debate, and I don't pretend that there's a singular answer on every question. We also have a rulemaking advisory committee. That's the familiar part. And then we have also the fiscal impact or financial impact committee, the common features of the rulemaking process. The reason we decided not to set these up as requiring 100% consensus of any of those groups is precisely the reason you say, is that, that you can't have a 100%
consensus. It's not consensus. It is statistical confidence.
Right.
They're two different things entirely. Let me give you one example, and I'll leave it alone. But when my wife's a petroleum geologist, when she started to school at Oregon State, the idea of plate tectonics was anyone who thought that was what was really going on was a fool. I mean, they were out there hanging ten. You know, 6 years later, when she got her master's degree, it was absolutely known fact, and you know, with virtually 100% statistical confidence, that's how it works.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it isn't perception. It's not consensus. It is statistical, reproducible fact. That's what I'm after.
Senator, I hear you, Senator Whitson, and what I hope is that the technical advisory group will help keep this process honest to good principles of how to evaluate those scientific questions. I think that it would be appropriate for me to simply allude to this slide. It represents graphically this partnership that I described that is being created even as we speak between the Department of Environmental Quality and Lynn Saxton's group, and I think at this point I would turn the podium over to her.
Thank you, Director Shepherd. Lynn Saxton, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. We are pleased to be here today talking about the Cleaner Air Oregon Initiative, and our goal is clear. Oregon's air toxics regulations will be aligned with health considerations, and the exciting part is throughout the course of the last 4 or 5 months, DEQ and their experts and the Oregon Health Authority Public Health Department's experts have been collaborating intensely. I think this work has produced not only interagency professional development, but improved understanding of the questions to be asked and the answers that we are seeking. We have a critical role at the Oregon Health Authority with our health experts in working more closely to protect people and communities, and I want to underscore again, this is a reliance on science, this is a reliance on data and evidence and best practice regulatory procedures, and we look forward to that challenge. I also want to underscore that we know poverty is one of the number one health risks in our state, and we can't have healthy people if we don't have access to employment opportunities, quality health care, and communities that support health and well-being. As we begin this work, we want to underscore that our new rules will strengthen the role of science and evidence, and we will be assessing not only health effects, but using testing, which we've been developing and expanding over the course of the last 4 to 5 months, and looking at our neighbor states, Washington and California and other states around the country, and the kinds of testing and science they are using to assess the health risk requirements. I want to particularly underscore that we will be using environmental public health assessments to protect public health and safety. It's really important to underscore that these assessments can determine human exposure to contaminants. They can evaluate if exposure is harmful. We can recommend if exposure should be stopped or reduced, and prioritize and identify actions that protect public health. It's also important to note the limitations of those health assessments. They cannot determine if existing health issues have been caused by environmental exposure, and they cannot determine individual health risk. As we move forward, we are committed to creating air quality standards that support health wherever Oregonians live, work, play, and learn, and we look forward to beginning this process in collaboration not only with the scientists in both agencies, but with the communities at large that we will be reaching out to throughout this process. happy to answer any questions.
I would just want to make a comment. When I was going to veterinary college, Dr. R. Keith Farrell taught the poisonous plant course. And after the final, each spring, we all went to, you know, the class went to his home, and he had a wonderful layout of food for everybody, and everything on the menu was poisonous. And he was making a point. The point is, just because it's there doesn't mean it has a cause. I mean, it's something I've never forgotten. You know, it's, what is this? You know, but it was. These are certainly some things that are in a poisonous plant basis that are, you know, a very small thing will kill you. But for the most part, it is just because it's there doesn't mean they ate it. Just because it's there doesn't mean it's toxic. One of the most toxic things known to man is apple seeds. If you eat enough of them, it's cyanide poisoning. It will kill you just dead, you know. But nobody eats that many apple seeds. So.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks, Lynn. I want to introduce Leah Felden, who is superintending, as I said, among her other responsibilities, the process that we call Cleaner Air Oregon. She's going to step you through some of the key features, including the community engagement functions.
Thank you, Director Shepherd. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Leah Felden. And I am currently and newly the special advisor to Director Shepherd for Cleaner Air Oregon. I'd like to tell you more about the public engagement process for the Industrial Air Toxics Regulatory Reform, also known as rulemaking, and what to expect. Both Director Shepherd and Director Saxton have spoken a bit about what Cleaner Air Oregon is and the importance of the two agencies working together. To add to that, Cleaner Air Oregon is really a mandate that the agencies, that we use our expertise, in other words, science and health, to inform industrial air toxics regulations. Our mutual agenda must be to create regulatory standards that link human health and the risks that toxics can pose in our airshed. Our new regulations, which will fold into our current permitting system, will go beyond technology-based standards for certain industry sectors and will instead apply more broadly and focus on the health impact of air toxics. DEQ, in partnership with the Oregon Health Authority, is creating many opportunities for the public to be heard during this rulemaking process. This slide shows the key forums where the public and interested stakeholders will have an opportunity to get involved. After I describe these events, I'll show you a visual timeline for the rulemaking. We're proposing an ambitious schedule and one that places importance on public education and input. In April, the Environmental Quality Commission adopted the temporary rules for glass manufacturers, which is the first item on the timeline that I'll be showing, and an important seg point for the launch of the Cleaner Air Oregon program, which you've heard about from Director Shepherd, and will reform Oregon regulations for toxic industrial emissions from all sectors statewide. This month and in June, Cleaner Air Oregon will hold two interactive webinars. The first webinar on May 26th is an educational and interactive webinar inviting the public to learn about industrial air toxics regulation in Oregon and the rulemaking process. We will have technical experts from DEQ, the Oregon Health Authority, and EPA to discuss the current state of regulation in Oregon and the rulemaking process. Participants in the webinar will be able to ask and have answered questions in real time, and the recorded event will be available on cleanerairoregon.gov for later viewing. The second webinar in June will also be educational and interactive with experts to present Washington's and California's approaches to human health risk-based regulations for industrial emissions, followed by an opportunity for the public to ask questions and provide feedback to help inform Oregon's rulemaking. During June and July of this year, a technical work group of subject matter experts in environmental, public health, and related fields will tackle the technical aspects of the rulemaking, such as risk assessment and pollutant concentration modeling, and provide an opportunity for the public to learn about the technical considerations that will guide the new rules. In September and October of 2016, public policy forums will be held at four locations around the state where DEQ and OHA staff will present policy topics, followed by an opportunity for the public to provide comment to inform the advisory committee discussions. During October and November, an appointed advisory committee that we've been discussing will convene to advise, recommend, and provide comments to DEQ and OHA on draft rules, incorporating public comment, the work of the technical work group, and the public policy forums. These are public meetings with time designated for public feedback. Rather than simply appointing this committee, DEQ is currently asking for input on the makeup of the advisory committee and will then solicit applications from those who wish to serve on the advisory committee this summer. In February and April of 2017, the fiscal advisory committee mentioned before will meet to discuss and make recommendations about the fee structure for the new rules and approve the fiscal impact statement. Based on this information, DEQ and OHA will continue to revise draft rules and open a public notice and comment period from approximately May through July 2017. There will also be a public hearing during this period. From August to October 2017, DEQ and OHA will review the public comment, respond, and publish comments on our website. The agencies may also revise the rules based on public comment. In November, DEQ's recommendations for the proposed rules will be made available to the public on the agency's website. In December, we will propose the rules to the Environmental Quality Commission. Throughout the rulemaking process, we will conduct additional engagement opportunities that connect with Oregon residents in places and settings where they want to engage. We will partner with groups and individuals from across the state to ensure a robust, inclusive process that connects with all Oregonians. Engagement with traditionally underserved portions of our community and others will be key to our overall success. The new website, cleanerair.oregon.gov, houses information on the rulemaking process and is also where people can sign up for updates, get information, and provide input.
It's .org.
Pardon?
.org. I've been trying to get a .gov and it's not coming up, but .org is.
Thank you, Senator Edwards, for bringing that up. We found that issue. .gov does work for most folks, but we've found that government actually trying to access the website has had trouble.
Clever.
Senator, we're interested in everybody's voice but yours.
DEQ, we've had the same problem accessing the website. So thank you.
We're working on it.
Okay.
Yes, yeah. Also cleanerairoregon.org is another way if you can't reach it.
Right.
We do plan to regularly update the site and share information and opportunities for dialogue, to host the webinars and presentations for the public, and to post updates for the media. I just want to flip briefly to this timeline so you can see a visual, and you'll have this in your materials for use after today. And if you want to refer back to it, it's a little bit of a busy slide, so I didn't want to leave that up there and have you focusing on that, trying to read it. But it kind of gives you the overall picture from April 2016 to December 2017. And I'm also happy to answer any questions that you might have. And otherwise, I'll turn it over to Brian Bowling, our laboratory manager, and he's going to talk to you a little bit about our monitoring efforts under the Cleaner Air Oregon initiative. Thank you.
I do have a question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dembrough.
Thanks, Leah. I think I know the answer to this, but I've received questions about the length of the rulemaking timeline, some frustration that it's as long as it is. So what is the answer to that? Why does it need to be a year and a half?
Sure. Senator Dembrough, it's a great question. We've heard that question as well. A typical rulemaking at DEQ usually is about a 10-month process. This is not a typical rulemaking process. And really, the most important thing for us in this process is making sure that we have a lot of public participation and public involvement in this process. So there are a lot of pieces on this timeline that are legal requirements in a rulemaking process under the Oregon Attorney General's model rules, such as the way that we conduct advisory committee meetings, having a public notice and comment period, having a public hearing. But then there are many pieces to this that are not required, but that we feel is necessary for a regulatory reform of this size.
It's a big, it's a great opportunity, and it's a large undertaking in that it will create regulations that are statewide and affect all different industry sectors. When you know many rulemakings will focus on a much more narrow piece of regulation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Demarest, let me give one example. The Administrative Procedures Act allows the rulemaking agency simply to appoint an advisory committee. We're building in time to consult with people about how that rulemaking advisory committee best could be not only formed but populated with specific names. That we want to make that opportunity real, and that's going to add some time. And you make a whole series of those choices in the course of the regular rulemaking timeline, and all of a sudden you're out quite a long ways.
So is there any so you've got this long rulemaking process. I commend how inclusive it is and thorough. Can the public be assured that there is not acute risk that's happening right now today that is being allowed to continue because we've got a long rulemaking process? And if there is a very real and present risk and danger right now, what tools do you have to stop that?
Senator, the short answer to your question is that the agency can't go to sleep in its responsibilities awaiting the outcome of this rulemaking process, and we're not. The rulemaking process is necessary because our tools are limited to address this systematically, but we do have some tools to address matters where, for example, if we have reason to believe a particular source of emission is emitting a dangerous amount of lead that is affecting a nearby schoolyard, we will do everything we can to cobble together the right tools to address that promptly and aggressively, as we believe we've done recently. We have Brian Bowling is going to describe to you a little bit the resources we have available for monitoring, and part of the monitoring deployment strategy, including around the collection of information that will feed into Cleaner Air Oregon, involves trying to identify the areas where it's most likely that we may have these kinds of immediate problems that are existing that we're not presently able to measure or able to identify with the specificity necessary to even apply the limited tools that we do have. And so we're very attuned to that. We don't have great tools to address those kinds of problems, but we are aggressively pursuing those when we are able to identify those locations and those instances when they occur.
If I might, Lynn Saxton, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. Chair Edwards, I might add also we've been in a process of monitoring, weekly monitoring for months now, and that all of the current efforts plus any other additional needs we identify in the process are consistently underway throughout this process with an opportunity to take actions as the Director outlined.
Hello, I'm Brian Bowling. I'm the Laboratory Program Manager for the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here today to talk a little bit about our air toxics monitoring program that we run out of our Hillsborough laboratory. We have approximately 70 scientists and field staff that operate out of our Hillsborough laboratory that go out throughout the state doing water and air collection and analysis. Today I'll try to answer a few questions. A few questions related to air toxics monitoring and our ongoing efforts. In this picture, I just like to note the different equipment that you see here, and I'll talk a little bit about it later. All the different various equipment that we need necessary to do air toxics analysis. Currently, we have a number of different types of monitoring underway, and historically, what we've done around air toxics. Sarah Armitage explained earlier some of the areas that we have done air toxics monitoring, but I'll highlight the times that we've done some of our monitoring. Starting back in 1999 up to about to today, we've had as high as 7 monitoring locations. These are what are considered full air toxic sites analyzing a number of different compounds, including metals, volatiles, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, combustion byproducts, formaldehyde, down to as low as two federally funded sites. We kind of ebb and flow as the general fund comes in and out through our agency. This is an area that we see a reduction occur. Currently, the air toxics that we do isn't like particulate matter or ozone, where there's a real-time instrument sitting out in the field collecting information the entire time, sending it back to our laboratory for us to look at. Our field staff have to go out to these locations. They have to pick up filter media. They have to pick up SUMA canisters. They have to look at the sites. They have to calibrate the instruments and bring them back to the laboratory for us to do the analysis. It's time-consuming and labor-intensive process to do this. There isn't real-time monitors out there. There is only really one real-time monitor, and that's for diesel particulate, which we consider an air toxics. In addition, newer technology is coming out on the market for real-time metals analysis, but unfortunately it doesn't see low enough or go low enough for our health targets. So while we could use the technology for arsenic, we would not, unable to use that technology for cadmium because we would not be able to see to those health targets that we want to see. So we're still using the labor-intensive process that we have to do in going out to the field every day. In the top left is just a picture of two of our monitors. Each of those different monitoring categories you see on the right require a different monitor. They range anywhere from as low as $5,000 for a volatiles instrument upwards of $15,000 to $20,000 for a diesel particulate monitor. The middle picture is a traditional site that we have. This was our North Portland site around Swan Island. That was a full site. A full site contains a trailer, a number of different monitors, a MET station, so that we can look at the wind direction, wind patterns, and know kind of where the toxics may be coming from. In the lower corners are our staff. All of these samples come back to the lab and take anywhere from a couple hours when you're doing gravimetric analysis or weighing a filter to look at particulate matter to as long as 3 or 4 days in order to extract the sample and run it on an instrument. Today we're in a different world. We've had the U.S. Forest Service come through and do a moss study, which was really revolutionary in the terms of looking at metals in urban environment. Their study provided a in-depth look at what moss concentrations were in the Portland area, a very valid statistical approach by looking at 346 sites for a full slew of compounds. There is about 25 compounds that they looked for in there. Currently, DEQ has reviewed five metals, cadmium, nickel, selenium, lead, and arsenic. That's the information they've been able to share with us and have publicly shared through their papers. They're currently reviewing their data, and we should see something in mid-June with the remainder of their data from this particular study. What this study allowed was to be able to identify potential hot spots or areas of concern for a particular metal. On the right-hand side, you see a cadmium map that was produced by them to look at cadmium concentrations they found at these moss locations. While the study is very valid and informative for looking at hot spots or areas of concern, what it doesn't tell us is the health implications. There is no direct correlation between what is in the moss and what human health concerns may be present from the air concentrations. These are not air concentrations. These are simply what was found in the moss. It takes additional follow-up work for us to understand what human health implications are from the moss studies.
So what started this whole thing off, the moss study months ago, so that the study just showed elevated levels, but it wasn't against like some standard moss benchmark. It was just elevated, and that created concern, and that's why you started digging into and trying to figure out where it is coming from.
That's correct. So the moss showed us that there was elevated levels of cadmium in the area, and where we went and with our partners put out an air monitor in October to look at air concentrations. And that's where we truly got to what the human health implications could be, because we had true air concentrations. And that's what we need to be able to relate back to our health targets.
So you just moved in the air monitor, you moved it from one place to another to try to get closer? Or, I mean, without the MOS study, we probably wouldn't be having this hearing today. I mean, it wouldn't, or we'd just be focusing on diesel because we were going to do that anyway. But, I mean,
What MOS provided us was a study that allowed us to get to what's near source or very close in to sources that we will not capture in our historical one-year-long air toxic study locations that we have run in say, North Portland. That looks at a full airshed. It looks at a wider area. It is not directly next to industry, per se. The MOS allowed us to look at metals concentrations next to those industries, a very close proximity. These MOS locations were 1 kilometer apart. And so while you have industry that may be small, it may still have an impact, and we see that through the MOS and the metals in particular. MOS allows us to look at metals. They also looked at PAHs or polycyclic hydrocarbons. But the data wasn't as good. There's still, it has some issues. And so while MOS was really good and looks good for metals, it may not be the perfect solution for looking at near source. And so that's where we're actually changing up some of our monitoring. And we have now 2 different monitoring going on. And you can slip on to the next slide. Where we're actually doing near source monitoring, where we are targeting a particular compound of interest in that vicinity, because full air toxics, when we are talking about a diesel particulate monitor, a VOC monitor, a PAH, the full gambit, is a very expensive year-long study. If we know there's a concern of a particular compound, we can go in there and, in a way, surgically analyze for that specific thing. And that's what we're doing in the Dalles with naphthalene, where there's a concern of naphthalene around the area, and we went in with 3 monitors to get to more of a statistically valid understanding of the area and collect that data for a shorter period of time, because one of the other concerns is the length of time this takes. Our benchmarks are annual benchmarks. They're an annual average. While we would love to have 3 locations to collect that much data, it's very expensive. And so going in there and changing our frequency, we normally collect 1 in 6 days. We shorten it down to 1 in 3 days, collect for 14 days straight. In addition, we can start to look at what is the picture in a snapshot. In a 90-day period, what is it looking like? Are we going to look like we're going to go over our ambient benchmarks? Are we having some short-term health implication that monitoring will allow us to see? And so we've started that in the Maritimes, or in the Dalles around the Maritimes. We've also started that in Hayden Island and looking at volatile organic compounds and hydrogen sulfide in that particular area. Where we are right now is we're heavily invested in metals analysis in the Portland metro area. We've got 12 sites running around 3 locations currently collecting metals data every single day. We've been doing that since the middle of February, was when the first site went up. And we've been running every single day. We have staff out collecting filters, bringing them back to the laboratory, and processing those samples. That information is very valuable. What occurred last week and those exceedances that we've seen was due to those filters being processed every single day.
Okay, so that I was just going to ask that. So how long from when you get information from a monitoring site to release to the public, what's the turnaround there, or and how long do you aggregate it and analyze it and review it before you release it to the public?
So we run, it's about an 8 to 10 day cycle period. We collect filters, field staff is out there every single day picking up filters and bringing them back to the laboratory, and then we take 4 or 5 days together and process those as a batch. Process through the instrument, and we're releasing the 3 locations in the Portland Metro currently weekly We release that data every single week, and we're seeing about an 8 to 10 day delay from that kind of the sample when it was actually sampled to when the data is released from our laboratory. Our laboratory goes through a number of quality assurance checks before release data. And each of those has to be done before we release the data to the public to ensure that quality data is present.
Senator.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that a certain amount of quality assurance, I think, is essential in this process because, after all, we're charged with the administration of legal standards as measured by a factual predicate for the application of those standards. And the standards, as we saw last week, they can be very consequential for the recipient of our attention if we bring the even limited tools that we have to bear on a situation. It can't, just the fact of the allegation is very significant from the other end of the action. So we want to make sure we got the data correct. So a certain amount of caution in terms of evaluating the information is essential. In the particular instance, two things to observe about this. One, the two agencies acted together to the full extent of our authority the day we got the information back from the lab with the assurance that it had been checked against our quality assurance standards. And number two, the reason that we were able to act today instead of on earlier occasions is that one of the gaps in the system that we had identified as a result of our experience earlier was that we didn't really have a principled way based in science and public health to answer the question, what is the 24-hour limit of exposure to certain of these materials? Those standards didn't exist until the toxicologists at the public health, the Oregon Health Authority, and our folks at DEQ got together and brought their best scientific judgment to bear on what those standards were. It's that standard, the creation of that standard, that allowed us to take the action that we did recently, and it didn't exist until just very recently. So I mark that as one of the ways in which we're making progress on this very difficult problem. That kind of standard making, I think, will be subsumed in the broader work that Clean Air Oregon ultimately is going to do, I think. In the long run, that's going to be the kind of thing that we do on a more systematic basis statewide. But at least for certain of the metals, we have been able to create some principled standards that we can hold people accountable to when we're able to measure the output.
And so if let's say there's an elevated level of something, and then you go and – so if there's an elevated level – but an emitter is operating within the bounds of their particular air discharge permit, then that is a regulatory gap.
Senator Edwards, that is...
And that you can't do anything about.
It's quite possible because our current regulations regulate to volume of emission and not explicitly to human health,
right.
We can't always answer the question expressly as to whether the level of emission permitted is necessarily a level of risk that we would accept as adequate for the community. The reason we acted in the particular instance is it was dramatically over these 24-hour principles that we'd established, and we had the counsel of our colleagues, the experts at the Oregon Health Authority, who said at that level we have an imminent threat to human health and particularly to kids.
Okay.
So show me another case like that where I can document it, and I'm going to recommend that we do the same thing.
Okay. And in this case, the same thing was to what?
The very awkward process that we're operating under, because we don't have a permitting standard that we could invoke under the circumstances, is an old statute that allows the Department of Environmental Quality to advise the governor as to our opinion, and we did that based on jointly with the Oregon Health Authority, of our opinion that an immediate and imminent threat to human health exists. I'm paraphrasing the statute,
yeah.
Senator, but and then based upon that advice, the governor promptly issued an order directing DEQ to enter the cease and desist order. That order is effective for 10 days, and what it prohibits in the particular case is the continued use of the problematic chemicals, except in a furnace that has the necessary controls that would limit those emissions to a point where where at least we would not find an imminent threat to human health. Now, that's not a very good tool. It's an awkward fit for an ongoing regulatory scheme, and it really calls out, I think, dramatically the need to have a more systematic approach to these issues.
And that regulatory gap, I mean, notwithstanding the ability, I mean, in this instance, you were able to get it to the governor. The governor was able to take action. But you have an ongoing, you know, to the extent that you have this regulatory gap, that is what you're working to close during the longer term rulemaking
that's
process.
That's exactly correct.
Okay. Senator Deborah.
Lynn, did you want to say something?
Chair Edwards, I just wanted to underscore that the Oregon Health Authority consistently has said over the course of the last 4 or 5 months that our particular concern was the proximity of the daycare center next to the industrial source, and we had consistently signaled that if we saw levels getting at a level that we thought was a risk to that location, that we would take action. So I think, again, it's noteworthy that the two agencies have been working in such close collaboration now for a period of months that we kind of are using the authority we have, but we're also being judicious in basing it on the science and the data we're collecting on an ongoing basis.
Thank you. Yeah. So, you know, a lot of attention, of course, has been on the glass manufacturers in the Portland area, and that's been addressed temporarily in the temporary rule, which gives you some authorities. The other source of concern and controversy is precision cast parts. And if the ongoing monitoring suggests, you know, that action needs to be taken there, do you have the authority to put requirements on precision cast parts?
Well, I think I'll ask Leah to address that, because in her former responsibilities, she, and she'll be returning to those, by the way, her appointment as a special assistant to me on this issue is temporary, but in the role of head of our enforcement unit, I think she's probably most able to address the kinds of remedies in general that we would have with respect to a permitted facility in the event we detect a violation of the terms of their permit.
Yes. Senator Dembrough, we have a few tools we could use. Again, we're still working within this, potentially within this regulatory gap that we've defined, but Precision Cast Parts does have a permit, and we have all regular enforcement authority under that permit. Should monitoring show that there is a problem there that is beyond the bounds of what they're required to abide by under the permit and current regulation, another option is to work on a mutually agreeable order with them. That's something that we did with the Uroboros Glass Company that you may have heard about early on, and that company was willing to sign an agreement with us to regulate their metals emissions further than the law actually prescribes. So that is something that we could look at. As you mentioned, we did propose the temporary rules, which they adopted, to the Environmental Quality Commission around the glass manufacturers, and we're happy to have that tool. However, to be frank, that, you know, bringing about that tool was a difficult and somewhat awkward process, because we kept running into the fact that really we need the statewide risk-based rulemaking to do this properly. When you need to look at things like risk assessment and pollutant concentrations, trying to just focus in on a very small point throughout of the whole state is makes that very difficult to do in a consistent and meaningful way. So we really look forward to being able to do the statewide regulatory approach.
Okay. Thank you. And another question, this is for Director Shepherd. So, you know, we're in that time of agency calendars where budgets are being proposed, you know, for next year. So is DEQ looking at a significant ask in terms of monitoring equipment? You know, as was mentioned, this equipment is expensive. We need it. The legislature is going to have to wrestle with how to pay for it. What do you envision as being part of the ask?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dembro, first, more immediately than even the agency request budget, we have a request pending before the emergency board for additional funds precisely to purchase additional monitors. Now, those are primarily necessary because we borrowed quite a number of monitors, 20-some-odd, from the Lane Regional Air Protection Authority as well as from the Environmental Protection Agency. And both those agencies have needs for their monitors, as we certainly do for other monitors. So in part, the emergency request is to backfill, largest part, backfill monitors that we're not going to have available to us at some point because the lenders are going to repossess their goods. Longer term, we are in the process of developing the agency request budget, and we do right now and have been discussing with our stakeholder group quite a variety of priorities for the agency, and we've included in that trying to identify as best we can a projection of what this new regulatory environment might imply in terms of our budget process. And right now, I would say to you, Senator, that it's too soon for me to even get my hands around how to do that projection. For one thing, of course, we're just at the earliest stages of formulating those rules, and it's very hard to understand exactly what the parameters of a principled request to you all would be. But it's on our radar screen, and it is one of the things that I think I have to participate in doing before I leave, because I at least have to have a way for the Assembly to consider that as the rulemaking process matures and it reaches a clearer way of projecting what those expenses would be.
I don't envy having to prepare a budget for next session.
Where you need, sounds like a significant increase in resources, and depending on what happens in November, you may be asked to cut a lot out of your budget. So
we're aware of that too. Yeah.
So I just got one last.
Go ahead.
So I just wanted to follow kind of where we're going next with our monitoring efforts. We do have moss follow-up at the five metals that we know of from the USFS. We've done some prioritization. We've currently I've been able to handle the cadmium and nickel locations. We're now working through the arsenic, selenium, but we're tapped out with monitoring resources. Every monitor that we have is deployed. Every staff member that we can within our air quality budget is fully allocated processing samples at this point. We do know that U.S. Forest Service will be coming out with the remainder of their data in mid-June, and that may potentially change our priorities based on what they have. In addition, we received additional funding in the last legislative session to install two more air toxics locations. Those will be up by the end of 2016. And we're also redeploying the Swan Island location, just finalized from its year-long study that is going to PCC in Southeast Portland, and will be there for a year doing a full suite. And then our second general fund that we've had site will be going to Gresham.
Mr. Chair, right. Thank you very much for the opportunity to visit with you about this. And we'd be pleased to answer any follow-up questions that you or your staff might have occur to you after the hearing.
Thank you each for the presentation and the work that you're doing on this issue.
Thank you.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. All right, next we're going to pivot to diesel emissions, and we have Kevin Downing and Nicole Eroz-Ilardo to present to us on diesel. We've got 40 minutes scheduled left. I've been told that each of you guys are around 15 minutes. Probably have some questions. So that is starting to bump into wood smoke work group update, I think they were scheduled for 15, was it about 15 minutes? So I'm gonna just try to keep clipping along here.
Great.
Go ahead. Well,
it looks like I'm up first. I'm Kevin Downing with the DEQ and the Air Planning Program in the Department of Environmental Quality. And I wanted to give you some background on the data around diesel. And so we've projected actually cancer risk from diesel particulate matter in Oregon. And as you might see on this, that we expect that the risk ultimately will go down over time. And this is due to the fact that the new engines are built with more advanced emission control systems to reduce particulate emissions. And as a result, we expect the cancer risk from diesel exposure to go down as well over time. What we see, though, in current modeling work that we've done in the Portland area, we projected actually growth, and including the turnover to newer engines, to result in this kind of a map in the Portland area that shows in the high red areas the elevated risk for cancer from diesel PM. So again, this counts for turnover in the fleet. We can see that it exceeds the Oregon Health benchmark in a number of areas throughout the Portland metropolitan area, and we expect, and not only that, but the results also suggested that in order to meet the benchmark would require reductions from diesel engines on the order of 89% to 92%, depending on the source category. So pretty significant reductions to get to that benchmark level.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
On this, the last two slides, this, and are those based on actual empirical measurements, or are those based on computer models with assumptions being made?
It's based on a model.
What's your statistical confidence in the model?
Very high. Actually, we've used these modeling techniques before in the past. It's there are inputs, of course, that may vary confidence one way or another in terms of the estimates of the sort of the age of the fleet as it stands now, and that actually could turn both ways. Right now, the default that's used in the models is actually based on the EPA turnover. Which is they estimate turnover to be at about 10% of the fleet turns over to new vehicles per year. And as we'll see a little bit later, that actually what we see in Oregon is that the turnover rate might be a little bit less than that, somewhere around 6%. So, in fact, these values may may very likely underestimate the impact that we actually see.
And a follow-up. Yeah. Have you done any empirical testing to test the validity of the model?
Let's see. I know that there's actually been monitoring work that's been done, but I'd have to go actually talk with other colleagues to say if we've done a model to monitoring comparison on this particular pollutant.
Thank you.
So we can get back to you on
that. I'd very much like to see that. Thank
okay.
you.
So this is actually the breakdown of the sources. So there's diesel engines are renowned for their durability, power, reliability, and economy, and they're widely used. Ultimately, they carry about 94% of the freight in this country is moved by a diesel engine in one form or another. In Oregon, we see the breakdown here that the majority of the emissions are from heavy-duty trucks, with a large also contribution from construction equipment, followed constantly by locomotive, marine, and ag sources and other sources as well. And to break down even the highway side even more, we can see that what we think of as classically, when you think of a diesel truck, is the Class 8, the heavy-duty trucks, that tractor-trailers that move long distances, that we see the majority of the emissions are from vehicles in that class, say a Class 6 and 7, 3, 4, and 5 are more like the intra-city delivery trucks that you might see around to that deliver appliances or whatnot to your door. The LDDTT are actually the pickup truck class these days, and you can barely see, but there are emissions from light-duty diesel vehicles. These are not common in the state. Gasoline is really the preferred power plant for cars.
Mm-hmm. I have another question. Going back to your pie chart, are those 2011? That's
yes.
5 years old?
Right.
Okay.
So you see actually what might happen over time as engines get cleaner on the truck side, we could expect that portion of the pie to go down. We would expect actually then those portions of the universe of diesel engines that turn over at slower rates or have, let's say, less comparably stringent emission standards, like, say, for instance, construction equipment where the standards have been in place for not as long a time, we might expect as a pie chart that slice to increase. The locomotive and marine side as well, it'll probably increase because the engines turn over there very much slower. And, the emission standards at this point are less stringent than they are on the truck side. So that's how we'd expect. You know, if you want to look at, say, a...
That was my point, because with your heavy-duty trucks, I think you just said a minute ago that you're turning over about 10, they're turning over about 10% a
that's
year.
That's projected turnover, yes.
And that would be, you know, would be a 50% difference in those on the heavy-duty trucks on from what that from the data you have there. Also, are you looking into two things? One of them is, particularly in trucks, are you looking into gas mileage or fuel mileage? Some of the newer trucks, some of the more experimental trucks, are going, you know, from 6 miles per gallon of diesel to 12 miles per gallon, which would are incredible reductions. And also, the even more than that is the compressed natural gas from standpoint.
Right.
Are you looking at are you studying those concepts as well?
Those are all excellent solutions to the problem. Improving the fuel economy is a way to actually get more work out of a vehicle using putting less energy in. It makes less of a difference on the newer trucks in terms of the actual emissions, the respirable pollutant burden, because now we're looking at the pollution controls on the tailpipe. So effectively that addresses, regardless of the fuel consumption used by the truck, whatever is coming out of the engine is being treated at the tailpipe through either particle filter or a selective catalytic reduction. Mm-hmm. The fuel economy improvements have addressed the climate change burden that might come from fuel consumption, and certainly returns value added to the user of the truck in terms of lowering their operating costs.
I guess one other point, and I'll leave it alone, but both the fuel mileage and compressed natural gas are something that can be market driven, because the compressed natural gas is not only cleaner, but it's a lot less expensive than diesel, and certainly getting twice the miles per gallon is a lot less expensive. So, rather than being regulatory, but, you know, if you focus on those type of things, the market would drive it.
Right. There are a number of great examples, as Senator Wood said, as you might know. Just recently, Fred Meyer moved a number of their trucks. I think 31 trucks in their fleet, off of diesel to natural gas, liquefied natural gas, which is actually great in terms of for both the respirable and, in this case, also the climate change pollutant burden that might come out of use of those vehicles. There's certainly a number of examples in the marketplace where people are looking at these kinds of issues and finding business-based solutions for them, like moving to natural gas or finding ways that they can improve the efficiency of their operations. Most notably might be reducing the idling of trucks while they're in their rest period, for instance, by being able to plug into the grid, which is extraordinarily more efficient than using the truck engine to provide that same housekeeping services that someone gets out of the truck. But those are excellent points you're making, yes. So what I want to do is sort of highlight sort of the breakdown, work into a little bit more of the detail in terms of where we are in terms of the trucks. So this is actually representative of the heavy-duty side of the sector. That is trucks above 26,000 pounds. So our Class 7 and Class 8 trucks in that nomenclature we were showing earlier. For a truck to operate, it requires a proportional registration, unlike your car, which is registered in Oregon and then allows you to travel freely among all the 50 states. With a truck, though, and heavy side, is that they register in the states in which they intend to travel. So this universe of trucks, say the 320,000 or so trucks, are trucks in this proportional registration universe that operate perhaps in Oregon, but also in many other states. In range, in impact, it's not like there's 320,000 trucks operating today, right now, this week, in Oregon. They range from trucks that may have come from, say, Georgia one day a week to come in to pick up a load of filberts, take it back to Georgia, or they could also be a truck that's based in Vancouver, Washington, that every day comes into Oregon on a regular basis. And you can see in this business model that this is a business part of the truck fleet that where they buy new trucks. That's their models. They buy new trucks and they run them many thousands of miles, and then they got turned into other fleets as well. And you can see that at this point that about two-thirds of that part of the universe are in the 2008 and newer engines, basically the cleanest engines that are, the cleaner engines that are out there right now. And on the Oregon-based side, which are those vehicles which are also in the heavy proportionally registered part of the universe but have registrations that limit their travel to Oregon alone, we can see that the numbers are virtually reversed, that about a one-third of those trucks are clean from a particulate point of view, and two-thirds of them are higher emitting. And most recently, I was able to get some data from DMV. So DMV registers the vehicles from 26,000 pounds down. This is a segment of the Class 3 to Class 6 trucks and a breakdown there. Again, looking at those trucks that are 2008 and newer, again, that have the lowest particulate-emitting engines. And we can see here that there's about 19% of that universe is actually in this clean truck segment. So I think the takeaway here I'd like you to consider is that if we're looking at this issue, that there's that it's the trucks that tend to operate more predominantly in Oregon are ones that are more likely the opportunity for us to move and find encouragement or other ways to move them towards lower emitting trucks, not necessarily having to think about the over-the-road truck fleets that we see that we predominantly think of as being a heavy-duty truck in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, can I make a couple points? One, if we're regulating the Oregon fleet more stringently than the other fleets, then Oregon people would be, you know, those 54,000 trucks would be more likely to be replaced by a new truck. And perhaps the 320,000 that are living coming from another state would buy the older trucks and use them, which isn't going to accomplish anything.
So, Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, actually, we couldn't differentially regulate an Oregon truck because the interstate commerce law would prevent us from saying a regulation that applies only to an Oregon vehicle cannot apply to a vehicle from out of state. It has to be applied uniformly across all the classes of vehicles that regulation affects.
So you would be regulating a Texas truck then? If it ran in
Yes,
Oregon.
that would be legally the avenue that we would have open to us. My point earlier was that if we were looking at trying to target activity, then that we have an opportunity within sort of those vehicles that are based in Oregon, so that that would be where the opportunity for change lies. Yeah.
And the other point I would ask you, if you look into, or if you haven't already, is the life cycle. Emissions on a truck. I mean, if you're going to replace a 2006 truck with a new truck, yes, the new truck is going to have a lot better emission level. But what does it cost to actually create the new truck?
That's right.
From the standpoint of emissions.
Yep. So similarly, this is an analysis of the breakdown of the non-road side of the emissions. Now here we don't have registration information like we have on the highway side. So the values here are derived from the EPA non-road model. So again, this is based on survey work that EPA has done, and we at this point still rely on the defaults that EPA has provided in terms of estimating the number and the distribution of engines in this sector. So we can see here, and I think the absolute value is assumed to be about 90,000 non-road diesel-powered engines. That's the full size of the pie here. Of that, based on the model, it projects about 34% of all the non-road vehicles to be Tier 4. Make that point again. So on the highway side, the emission standards are set by model year of the engine. Generally, 2007 and newer is going to have a particle filter, be very low emitting on particles emissions. At 2010, there was a requirement to lower the NOx emissions from diesel engines as well. On the non-road side, the pattern is not as straightforward. It varies by the horsepower and the model year of the engine, depending on what tier it's in. But Tier 4 is currently the lowest emitting federal standard at this point. So what we've been able to do is, since 2001, we've been engaged in an effort called the Oregon Clean Diesel Initiative, where we've engaged with people and fleets all over the state. We've been able to take advantage of a number of state general fund, federal grants, and tax credits. We've spent, DEQ has directly spent about $5.9 million in federal funds, about $750,000 in general fund, and $3.6 million in tax credits to either promote installation of advanced exhaust controls on engines, to do engine repowers, basically taking an old engine out, scrapping that engine, and replacing it with a newer, lower-emitting engine, as well as vehicle replacement projects. And we've hit about 755 engines to date. We've been able to reduce, as a result of that, 50 tons of diesel particulate. And just to bring you back to this original slide, that I started with. When the legislature gave us a goal in 2007 to reduce the risk of cancer in diesel engines to 1 in a million by 2017, so if we look at what that looks like, it means reducing about 1,400 tons total. That's on top of the that we would get from normal turnover. So this is the opportunity for us to get reductions sooner than what we'd expect from just simply waiting for this problem to resolve itself. And what we have been able to do, which has been effective in terms of the work that we've done, but we've reduced this to, say, about 15 tons total, leaving about 1,300 and change of tons still needing to be reduced in order to get us to the risk reduction goal. This has been a great opportunity for us. We've been able to engage with a number of partners and bring successful projects to fruition. And there's significant challenges facing us in terms of what we're looking to be able to do going forward. So thank you for your time and any questions you might have.
I have one question on the last slide there. How do you determine what the cancer risk is from diesel and what form of cancer are you talking about?
Right, Senator Chair Edwards and Senator Whitsitt. So let's see. So let me start with the last one. So the work that's been done to identify cancer risk as a known carcinogen is focused on increased risk for lung and bladder cancers. And in terms of getting to that, what's that number? It's actually based on a review of a number of scientific studies that have looked at epidemiological work that have identified increased risk for, in this case, cancer, based on exposure rates and through a very complex process that I couldn't even begin to describe to you right now. We are able to get up to a unit risk factor, which in the state of Oregon we use as we set to meet a public health risk. Is 0.1 micrograms per cubic meter represents the exposure level at which over a lifetime you'd expect an increased risk for cancer in a population greater than 1 in a million. Is that confusing or straightforward?
Mr. Chair, being a
masochist. We've got another presentation on health effects.
Being a masochist, I would, you know, if you have some of that information, I'd really like to have it. And yeah, I don't need to burden, you don't need to burden the whole committee with it. I'd like to see it.
Well, let's see what we can put together that might be manageable and understandable yet.
Thank you. Go ahead.
We'll wait for this. So my name is Nicole Iverzalardo. I hold a PhD in urban studies, and I am pleased to be here with Chair Edwards and the rest of the committee to discuss air pollution and the health costs of that. I am a program manager for UD4H, Urban Design for Health, but I have in recent past, within the last 2 years, also been an employee of Oregon Health Authority in the Public Health Division. So my research specializes in understanding the connections between the environment, broadly defined, and population health using tools such as health impact assessment, not exclusively, but often with that. I'd gone to this because it is important to understand that environment, built natural and social, is a larger predictor of human health than our genetics and individual behaviors. So I tend to build health impact assessment tools that help provide governments the ability to understand the trade-offs between various policy levers. And this provides me with very unique insights as to what the relative trade-offs are between, say, cancer risk and cardiovascular risk of air pollution versus going out and exercising. Like the rest of the public health field, I am increasingly convinced that health is affected by and thus deserves consideration in all policies at multiple levels of governance. So I commend you on looking at this today. So what is the state of the science? What do we know about pollution and health? And up here I have a slide that summarizes the state of the science as the EPA provides it. They do integrated science assessments in preparation for the regulatory rulemaking. And here we see for three of the six criteria pollutants that the EPA directly regulates, particulate matter is measured by PM2.5, ozone, and nitrous oxides. We see short-term and long-term exposures. And what I want to point out is the extent to which we are absolutely, positively sure about certain health links. We know there is sufficient epidemiological evidence to understand that there is a causal link between cardiovascular disease and particulate matter, both in morbidity and in mortality. We see a similar, absolutely highest level of confidence between ozone and respiratory disease and mortality. So we're really quite certain of these things. We're also pretty certain about things like cancer, and I don't want to undersell that, especially in the context of the current issues that we're having in Portland with industry. But we are really, really certain of this cardiovascular and respiratory. And I would also like to state that the magnitude is generally 1 to 2 magnitudes higher. These are, when I speak of these cardiovascular and respiratory issues, these are issues that are happening annually, and they are a higher incidence than our cancer. So today I'm focusing on particulate matter because that is a subset of, or not that is a subset set, but the diesel emissions particulate matter is a subset of all particulate matters. I could tell you a similar story about ozone, to be quite honest. But the path to poor health from particulate matter comes because it is so small that when we breathe it in, our lungs are not able to filter it out. It just goes directly into the bloodstream, causing systematic stress to our system. And so if you have other underlying cardiovascular or respiratory diseases, this can trigger even worse conditions and ultimately death. We are also increasingly getting to the point in the science where we understand the link, whether it does it cause or just exacerbate lung disease, does it cause low birth weights and some of these other more secondary health effects. So I think one of the most interesting, although sad, epidemiological relationships that are out there in the literature right now is a one-day lag that comes off of an increased exposure to particulate matter. So the American Health Association, or the American Heart Association, has stated in their scientific consensus statement that every day with a 10 microgram per cubic meter increase in particulate matter results in a one-day lag of a premature cardiovascular death for 5 million people. That's the statement that comes from combining a bunch of different epidemiological studies through a meta-analysis. It's pretty rock solid. If we translate that into a region of 2.3 million in Portland, we're looking at every 2 days of an 11 microgram per cubic meter increase in particulate matter of 2.5 diameter results in a one-day lag of 6 heart attacks. And we know for every 6 heart attacks or strokes that, like, at least one dies. So this is a pretty heavy toll on our population.
Could you give us some... So that's every 2 days of 11 microgram...
Right. So to
per cubic meter increase.
Right,
how
right.
How much is that?
So how much? That's a very good question, Chair Edwards. It is the yearly average that the EPA regulates is set at 12 micrograms per cubic meter. And Portland's average, yearly average, sits around 8. So
you have a temperature inversion someday and the air is stagnant, the wind's not blowing, then is that like,
yes.
Is that what we're talking about?
So that's, I mean, what
like
we're talking
what type
about.
Of I'll range
give,
are we looking
I'll
at?
I'll give a really extreme example in a second, but yes, that is what we're talking about. So for every 2 days of inversion, we're talking, and that's about what the increase happens in inversions in Portland. For every 2 days of that inversion, we are talking about 6 additional heart attacks and 1 additional death. So it's a pretty steep relationship.
Okay.
We know this information from lots of different epidemiological sources, but a lot of it actually are natural experiments that come from things like inversion layers or wildfire incidents. And so when I don't have access anymore to the health records out of the emergency room. But last August 22nd, as I sat there working at my desk and I could start smelling the smoke as the winds shifted and brought in all that air pollution from the gorge fire, I knew additional people were going to go to the hospital that day. They were going to go because they were at higher risk. They had pre-existing conditions, and they were going to go with heart attacks, strokes, and significant pulmonary issues. How many? You know, that's what we all sat there watching as that time went on. And what I show here is, so we have these air quality index, and that's going to be the easy way that the public is able to understand what the context of, you know, is it a green day, is it a yellow day, is it a red day, right? These were red days. But we can back those out into concentrations, and from that we can predict how many cardiovascular events there were. And over those 2 days, the next following 2 days, you would have seen about an additional 46 to 47 cardiovascular or stroke events, and of those, approximately 8 would have died. Before I close out and open it up for questions, I also want to acknowledge that as the representative from OHA said earlier, that poverty is an extreme predictor of disease. And so we have to be very mindful about what things cost when we go into a regulatory environment. However, we also have to be very mindful about what poor health is costing our society and costing our government. So we know that there are that it is costly to go to the hospital. So I've concentrated on cardiovascular disease today. That's about a $38,000 bill. If you go to the hospital for an asthma issue, it's usually, and you're admitted, that's usually about a $14,000 bill. Oregon spent in Medicare and Medicaid alone in 2011 about $28 million on asthma. And cardiovascular medical expenditures for the state of Oregon in 2011 were over $1 billion. So to put this in context, you know, if we got rid of PM 2.5 exposure, how much can we move this needle? Well, you know, the cardiovascular disease is probably somewhere in the 4 to 8% of that. So it's not $1 billion, but it is not an insignificant amount of money that we are spending because we are polluting our air on healthcare expenditures. And we probably need to be doing a little bit more of this in our cost-benefit analysis or fiscal statements as we move forward. With that, I would like to thank you again for being here and ask if there are any questions.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Would you back up, Doctor, to your third slide, the state of the science?
I would.
If you look at the next to the bottom line on cancer, according to EPA, the PPM 2.5, the ozone, the nitrous oxide, nitrous dioxide are all either just suggestive of causal or inadequate to infer cause of cancer. How does that comport with what we heard earlier?
We are pretty sure. We don't see, luckily, because we have gotten to the point where industry is not allowed to pollute to
really
the extent that it was in, say, the Industrial Revolution. We do not have the science right now to be able to show that causal evidence of little teeny tiny changes. And that's what you're seeing there in terms of some of your heavy metals. We're relatively certain.
Then why does it say that inadequate to infer then?
Because we are very, very, very certain about cardiovascular disease and respiratory disease. And some of this is also, that's all cancers. And so there are different levels for different cancers. For instance, we are very sure about lung cancer and bladder cancer, but not so sure about some other cancers. And so taken as a whole, the EPA has come out with this criteria.
So this is all based on epidemiological?
toxicology and epidemiological. Generally, if you don't have a toxicology base, you don't go out looking for it. And as epidemiological, it's not always true, but that's generally the way it tends to go.
So explain to a layperson what you just meant by if you don't have a toxicological base, then you have to go out for epidemiology.
So epidemiology leverages the law of large numbers, mm-hmm. right? We go out and we look and we take these huge surveys or get surveillance systems, and we use that to show these changes. It doesn't necessarily always show causation unless there's a longitudinal element within the study design. And so for the things where there are five dots, those are areas where we've seen that longitudinal element in that study design. We're seeing the pre-post, right? Toxicology, we don't go out and do epidemiology like that until we are pretty satisfied that there is a plausible biological connection. And that is generally driven from the toxicology world, in which we've seen it in lab situations, and which we've also seen it in industry worker situations, where you, by working at a specific plant, have been exposed to really high levels of a certain something, and therefore we know at really high levels this is a cancer risk. But as it comes down, we don't always know what the relationship is at low levels, and so maybe that's also an additional reason why there might be only three circles there instead of four circles. So where you are on that curve matters. What's interesting about particulate matter is that there is no threshold level at which it is safe, and in the ranges we see in the U.S., it tends to be really linear. So that change in 10 micrograms or 11 micrograms is just as important at the low range as it is in the high range.
Yeah, this is interesting. I'm trying to figure out I'm trying to imagine where the toxicological evidence comes from for certain things. I mean, you know, in the workplace, then I can see, like, okay, yeah, if you get a cancer cluster and
right.
there's, you know, a lot of the people work at a certain plant, or, you know, they're
yeah.
exposed to certain toxins or whatever. But then among other populations, like pregnant moms, I'm trying to figure out, like, okay, where do you get that? Where do you get that information?
Because we don't put pregnant moms at risk anymore.
general environmental.
So, Senator Edwards, I think that my understanding of the studies that have been done on this are primarily workplace exposures, so truckers, coal miners, railroad employees. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about those results is not that perhaps that you find that exposures at high levels that there might be an elevated risk for a variety of health effects, including cancer and heart disease and whatnot, but that at lower levels, at lower concentrations, you see at ambient levels that we see in the ordinary air, that we see elevated risk. And in terms of the comparison of this work to other work, so that recently there was some work that was published since this was EPA assessment was done, that the World Health Organization, through the International Association for Research on Cancer, moved diesel exhaust from a probable human carcinogen to a known human carcinogen. And to point out there, the differentiation there is that this is actually talking about PM, but the IARC concluded that whole diesel exhaust, that is the entire constituency itself, represented a known human carcinogen. In comparison to that, they also looked at the same time to the published research on gasoline exhaust, and there they concluded that they're on that spectrum of risk. They said, let me get this right, that it's suspected human carcinogen, which then to move to suspected,
to
probable, and then known. So clearly the work is much more strongly identified in terms of the diesel risk as a contributor towards elevated risk for cancer.
Senator Dembro.
Well, I was just going to say that, I think the effect, on cardiovascular and respiratory is going to be more immediate, right? And I think that the causal relationship with cancer in general is more, it's not as direct, right?
There's a latency period.
So, and that latency period would be true for all cancers, wouldn't it?
that Senator Dimbra, that would be true for all cancers. And then you have the added challenge that statistically speaking, you need a bigger sample size when there are very small risks. So something can be carcinogenic, but at a relatively low risk. We want it to be at a relatively low risk, like we want it at one in a million. You're going to need a much bigger sample size to detect that. Mm-hmm. And so that's another reason why the science is moving a lot quicker right now in particulate matter and ozone, is because the effect size is much larger, so we don't need as big of a sample size to see that and nail that down really, really clearly.
Makes sense. Okay. Thank you. Thank you both for the presentation.
Thank you.
We're running short on time, but we have somebody here to give us an update on the wood smoke work group, Rachel Sakata. And I notice folks are, you're always free to take pictures of the information. Just know that if you want the information that's on the board, slides as they come up, they are available on the, we call it the OLIS, the Oregon Legislative Information
System,
probably. And if you need any help with that, Beth Riley, our committee administrator, can help you get that information. So,
good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. I'm Rachel Sakata, and I'm an air quality planner at DEQ, and I'm the key staff person leading the DEQ Wood Smoke Work Group. And I'll try and sum this up in 5 minutes, because I know we don't have much time. So you've already heard a lot about the health effects of PM, so I won't go into that. And basically, wood smoke contains particulate matter, PM2.5, as well as air toxics. And wintertime residential wood burning is the most significant source of fine particulate matter in most communities in or on the verge of non-attainment. So as you've heard earlier, non-attainment means that the area is violating the federal health standard for air pollutants, and Oregon has had a number of areas violating standards for particulate matter, and back in the mid-1980s, but they were quickly brought back into compliance. However, we're still challenged because over the years, EPA has made the particulate matter health standard progressively more protective for public health. And as you can see by the graph, the latest revision in 2006 lowered it by half, down to 35 micrograms per meter cubed. So that has made it difficult for past non-attainment communities to stay in compliance, and has put new areas at risk of non-attainment. And you can see from the map here which areas are violating or at risk, for example, Oak Ridge and Klamath Falls. And Senator Whitsitt, you'd also asked a question about monitoring in communities and how often we assess the location of the monitor. And I just wanted to mention that in Klamath Falls, we actually did do a monitoring survey there in 2010. So we did sort of look around to make sure that where the monitor was located was the correct location. So it was about 5 years ago, five, 6 years ago, sorry. Don't know my dates.
It's still behind that big tree.
Well, I think
used to be a little switch when it was there.
Certainly. So anyway, across Oregon, the high PM2.5 levels driving the non-attainment risk are universally caused by excessive wood stove smoke. So because of the growing concern about health and economic effect of wood smoke in communities across Oregon, Representative Johnson sponsored House Bill 3068. And this bill was geared to tackle issues facing these at-risk communities through a study specifically to examine wood smoke in these communities. A number of topics that the work group has focused on included ways to reduce wood smoke, exploring options for reducing old wood stoves for cleaner burning devices, looking into the use and production of biomass fuel, and options for reducing the cost of wood stove alternatives during poor air quality days. And all of this will result in recommendations for legislation or funding requests to you, the legislature, related to reducing wood smoke in Oregon. So the wood work group members reflect a range of stakeholders affected by wood stove smoke and biomass, including those from rural and urban communities. And the map here shows the representation of the work group. And we've got folks, elected officials, public health officials, so we try to get a good representation from the state. We've currently held 4 meetings so far, and the group has had great discussions and information sharing with real-world examples and realities of how communities are trying to tackle the problem and what will
will and will not work. For example, an acknowledgement that there's a strong culture of wood stove use. There's a lack of staffing to implement programs, that there's an easily accessible wood supply, and that there are economic barriers to struggling communities. And it has led to a vision of what is needed to be successful in tackling the wood smoke issue and helping these communities. Oh, I also forgot to mention that there are a number of state agencies also on the work group as well. So all the work group members agreed that a key piece of wood smoke reduction efforts must involve increased community funding, which would allow them to fully fund a dedicated local staff person year-round in each community. Over the past decade, community support funding has been reduced, and the funding currently provided is simply inadequate to support all the work that needs to happen in these communities across the state. Now, this funding comes from money provided by the legislature, which DEQ then passes on to the communities. The local staff person then in each community would be able to spearhead any local air quality program year-round, including providing information and assistance, coordinating a wood stove curtailment, wood stove replacement, and home weatherization. And another key part is having this person helping to write grants to help fund changeouts, education efforts, plus additional projects. And the person could try to obtain these grants through federal, state, private, and philanthropic organizations. Communities also indicated that knowing that there is a consistent and sustained funding to help with their work makes it easier for them to budget and also to solicit grants and matching funds to buttress their work. So, as mentioned earlier, by focusing on local community funding, it allows the community to immediately engage to bring PM 2.5 levels down. And as a next step recommendation, the work group also supported a wood stove changeout program with funding, and this provides a long-term approach for a community to address wood stoves. Communities would need to submit a proposal of how they would implement the program and identify funding partnership opportunities. And each changeout program would span 2 years to allow the community to get the program running, and at the end of the project, a report would be provided to the legislature regarding the program's effectiveness and lessons learned. And this is designed to be a sustainable program with a reoccurring ask for funds every 2 years. One other recommendation that came out of the work group was to conduct further study of biomass fuels, specifically biobricks or biologs. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar with biobricks, they're basically a compressed wood fuel made of compressed sawdust. So they're about 2 inches by 4 inches by 6 inches, so about that yay big or so. Some can be bigger. And these can be burned in a wood stove along with firewood. And so the work group discussed the potential for biobricks to be a lower cost emission option for households to utilize, particularly during poor air quality days when they may not be able to burn in wood stoves, but they couldn't possibly use this as a different option. However, additional research is needed to understand the emissions and safety characteristics of biobricks and recommends conducting a biobrick study to gather information on this promising source of fuel. Another recommendation was to fund supplemental projects if funding is available and can be matched by other funds. And these supplemental projects could include a firewood exchange where residents turn in freshly cut wood for properly seasoned wood, because properly seasoned wood needs to be out for about 6 months to a year. A heating fund to assist residents who must rely on alternate sources of heat because they cannot use their wood stove during poor air quality days. And a wood stove bounty program that provides a cash amount for any old uncertified wood stove that is turned in. And so communities could utilize options for these strategies to be implemented in their communities, in addition to any education, wood stove curtailment, and changeout programs underway. So overall, what we heard from the work group was that it was important to build upon and package these recommendations together to really be effective in these communities. So in conclusion, DEQ is going to be taking the work group's recommendations on a roadshow across the state to solicit solicit feedback and hear any additional suggestions that should be brought back to the work group for consideration. And here's a map of these communities that we'll be going to. And I had a little animation to show where we were going and whatever and different areas, but we're selecting communities that have dealt with wood smoke issues in the past. And then we'll take these thoughts and wrap up with a final work group meeting this summer so that DEQ can finish the report and submit it to you by September of this year. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions? Thanks for the work.
Sure.
Sometimes I wonder how many, or have you assessed how many wood stoves there are? I mean, I know some communities are more prevalent than in others, but sometimes it just feels like, if this is such a bad problem, it's been going on for so long, can we not figure out a way to...
So, Chair Edwards, we have done...
I am all out or something.
...surveys to assess the number of wood stoves. I can tell you that we estimate there are approximately 160,000 uncertified wood stoves across the state. So that's for the uncertified devices. I'd have to go back and look at how many certified wood-burning devices, and that doesn't include fireplaces and other things like that.
Okay. I do have one quick question, Rachel. So has there been a consensus on the group that among the group that... the focus be on the non-attainment areas or those that are areas of concern, that if we're going to have a program, that that's where we're going to target resources first?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dembro, yes, the work group has certainly discussed how important it is to focus on those non-attainment communities, simply because A, they are breathing unhealthy air, as well as suffering from economic challenges. But there are a number of other communities that are at risk, and we're trying to make sure that they don't get non-attainment. So I think they've discussed how they would give potential priority to the non-attainment areas, and then go from there.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you. Senator Dembro, you want to give us a quick update on what's happening with the diesel work group before we adjourn?
Sure. Just very quickly, we have a process underway kind of similar to the diesel work group, but we're a little bit behind. It's a work group that has been designed to work on the issues that you've heard already related to diesel. And it follows some legislation that was proposed back in 2015 that had us looking at the diesel problem through a combination of incentives, regulation, construction contracting standards, idling. It became very quickly apparent to us back then that there were a lot of questions that we were going to have to work on, and it made sense to form a work group to address that. And so this work group has just been formed and had its first meeting. The legislative members are myself and Senator Olson, the vice chair of this committee, and on the House side, Representative Vega Peterson, and Representative Mark Johnson, the vice chair of the Environment, Energy and Environment Committee. And we have representatives from industry, both large entities and small. We have both on the on-road side and the off-road side. We have public health and environmental advocates. We have local government elected members. We have agency representatives. We have a scientist from Portland State University and some other people. It's a large group. People contact us every day trying to get on it. We're, Beth Riley, who is ably administering this, has her own baseball bat that she's just trying to keep people away so that we can keep this contained. But, we are, I think I'm not going to go too far in saying where we'll be in September, but I'm hoping we can come back with a report to you in September. We will have had probably four meetings by then. And there's a lot of work to be done. We need to, as you heard, we have a certain amount of information about the trucks, the on-road side. There are a lot of questions to be answered about just how many diesel construction machines, engines are out there. And so one of the first things we're doing is designing a survey to find out just what we're talking about. We'll be looking at, in our next meeting, we'll be looking at what has been done to date here in Oregon, looking at some programs in other states, what's been happening in local governments, then also looking at what are DEQ's existing authorities to regulate diesel. We'll be talking about that at the next meeting. Anyway, just finally, I'll say that we will have a website on which we're going to place all of the research that we have and a number of the studies that are out there, as well as other information that's generated as a result of this work group. The more I find out about this subject, the more convinced I am that this is something we need to address. You know, as Senator Whitsitt said, there are market solutions to this, but we need to kind of juice those market solutions. This is a problem that will go away in about 30 or 40 years, but the question is, how many people will it take with it? And so how can we facilitate a shortening of that transition from towards the newer, cleaner technology? So that's the purpose, the mission of this work group.
Now, that's a work group for the website. I've never been a part of a work group for the website before.
Yeah, this is the 21st century.
All right. Thanks for the update. And we are adjourned. And we are adjourned.